All right, everybody's microphones on, please. Thank you. All right, good morning, everyone. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order on June 14th, 2024, at 9:01 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C. Could I please have roll call?
Robert Charles. Christina Gross.
Here.
Lynette Hedigan. Crystal Krueger.
Here.
Jose Luis Madera.
Here.
Adelisa Meek.
Here.
Dominic Miller.
Present.
Diane Palacios.
Hello, good morning.
Mark Shen. Antoine Trotter.
Present.
Thank you. My name is Adelisa Meek. I'm a licensed professional counselor, a licensed independent substance abuse counselor, and I'm the board's chairperson. At this time, I would like everyone to please make sure that your phones are on silent or turned off. For your convenience, throughout the meeting, vending machines are right outside this room and the restrooms are across from the elevators. A couple of reminders, this is an open meeting and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. Please be sure, if you are speaking on the record, that you speak clearly and into the microphone. In order to protect privacy, please keep in mind if it is necessary to refer to clients or former clients during the meeting, including if they are the complainant, to please use initials only. At this time, I would ask my fellow board members and board staff to introduce themselves, and we're going to start with Ms. Krueger.
Crystal Krueger, professional. Krueger.
Antoine Trotter, public member.
Christina Groves, professional.
Dominic Miller, LCSW, professional member.
Hello, Diane Palacios, licensed professional counselor, licensed independent substance abuse counselor, professional member.
Jose Luis Madera, LPC, professional member.
Holly Knapp, deputy director.
Jared Carver, investigations manager.
Toby Zavala, executive director.
Scott Donald, assistant attorney general, acting board counsel.
Kendra Claridge, renewal specialist, filling in for Allison Taylor, operations manager.
Thank you. We will now move to agenda item number 3. Minutes. We have May 10, 2024, general meeting minutes. Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair, yes, we do not have quorum for matters 3A and B.
Okay, so matter 3A and B are now tabled due to quorum. So we move to agenda item number 4. The agenda item number 4 are our consent agenda. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff. Board members have reviewed all of the materials and the recommendations. We are prepared to vote on each matter as it appears on the agenda. Before doing so, I will call each matter to see if anyone is here who wishes to pull the matter. Pulling the matter means that you are a party to the matter, you do not agree with the recommendations, and you would like up to 5 minutes to address the board. If you do wish to pull the matter, please raise your hand when I called it so that I can make note that you are here. So we go to item 4A, cases recommended for dismissal. I have Charmaine Bellamy, Rebecca Lane. Do you want to pull the matter? Okay.
Are you the licensee or the complainant? Okay.
Thank you. Jay Shelton, Callie Scalco, Christopher Sobel, Chelsea Valerie, Damon Winter. Are you the complainant and your wish to pull the matter? Do I have a motion to recommend dismissal for items 4A, 1, 3, 4, 5 and 6.
Palacios moves.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries. Now we go to item 4A2, Rebecca Lane. The complainant, you can come to the front, please. Right there. Thank you. Give me 1 second. I have my notes here. Okay, so what we do is first we listen to a summary from board staff, and then after that, you will have up to 5 minutes or greater, depending on how long the summary takes, to address the board. Ms. Zavala?
Yeah,
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the board, this matter was on the consent agenda. Based on review of the investigative record, there did not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for Ms. Zavala? No questions? So you're Ms. Spiker?
Speaker. I know.
So thank you.
That's wrong.
So you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay. So I'm not quite sure how to do this other than Becky Lane was the major impact in a DCS case that I had where my child ended up driving himself to the hospital and for a possible drug overdose. It turns out that he wasn't drug overdosing, and Becky Lane did call me to let me know when I was at work, and I went to the hospital. The hospital doesn't know how Becky Lane knew. The crisis team was not there. However, since that time, I had 2 CFT meetings with Becky Lane, and we were waiting on an inpatient program. And in between that, because also my child was going to a charter school, it then became so that my child was 24/7 supervised, was going to Spectrum from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. However, DCS stepped on in and said that I was not doing anything to address my child's illicit substance use. And that is completely false. Becky Lane went on to the record and said that during the DCS meeting, saying that I had several no-call, no-shows for my child and that my child never graduated a program, and that's a lie. In fact, she did, and I'm the one who inserted everything. She did go to a program that was Mingus Mountain program. She did graduate from that, and that was a year beforehand. And then she went to Spectrum after getting out of that program, and they even gave her a certificate of completion. So I noticed a change in my daughter's attitude and had her go back to counseling. And then that's when the drug overdose thing happened. It's not right to sit there and lie and say that somebody did no call, no shows, and that their child did not graduate a program, and they did, because I was doing everything possible for my child. My child was 17 years old. And to possibly think that your child did overdose on your way to the hospital is absolutely terrible. It's a feeling that no parent can ever describe. And thank God my child wasn't. But I was doing everything responsible for my child because I care about my child. And Becky Lane even went and told me to go and give my child some marijuana to help with her withdrawals. That's illegal, first of all. And because I was open and honest with DCS, and then I told Becky Lane that I said that, she told me, so you threw me under the bus? And that's not right. And even the DCS supervisor told me how she was good friends with Becky Lane. When a parent is trying to do everything right for their child, she needs the support from people. And I reached out. There was no court order. There was no demand for anything. I did it all on my own because I care about my child and I love my child. What she did was wrong. And I'm fearful of if she does that to another family, because it's not right. She said that she knew of a drug problem going on with my child, then why didn't you call me and let me know? Because that could have saved my child from going to the hospital thinking that she did drug overdose after she went to a counseling appointment that Becky Lane went and counseled her on. To me, it's absurd that if somebody knows that your child is doing drugs, why don't you call the parent and let the parent know? And not just let all these events happen and then lie about to cover up your own butt. That's not okay to me. Go ahead.
Thank you. Do any board members have any questions for the complainant? No questions. Thank you. And do we have the licensee present? Okay. So you can go back and then we have the licensee come forward. Ms. Lane, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Good morning. I would just summarize the documentation that I've already submitted to the board, which has been reviewed. I appreciate Brooke Spiker and the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners for making the issues of this complaint known to me. I have and continue to place extensive effort towards maintaining my professional responsibilities as a provider of our citizens of Arizona. ACA Code of Ethics states that counselors continually monitor their effectiveness as professionals and take steps to improve when necessary. I deeply value and actively seek feedback from clients, families, colleagues, and other agencies within the community in order to maintain my reputation for being open, honest, and transparent. I also wish to acknowledge the distress expressed by Ms. Spiker in her letter. During my chart review, I recalled many moments of shared concerns, frustrations, and overall deep levels of fear as we worked together to provide safety and security for Max as he battled with complex symptoms of substance dependence and trauma. I recall during times of intense family stress, encouraging Mac and Brooke to remain focused on...
Sorry. Hold on just 1 second.
Am I at time?
Hold on 1 second. Are we good?
Give us 1 second. We just got kicked out and we're getting back on. But I think we're back. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry for that. Please continue.
Let's see. Yeah. I'm just going to go to the conclusion here. I was talking about terminology where I used the language.
Okay. Yes. Uh-huh.
So when DCS takes temporary custody versus guardianship, the correct use of language should be employed in documentation depicting the correct status. Although I have been aware of this use of language during my practice, it seems that I made a mistake in the use of language citing guardianship versus temporary custody. So we would say DCS takes guardianship, but it's not. It's temporary custody within that 72-hour period. And so I was using the wrong language in that regard. I likely made the mistake as a result of habitually using guardianship and other progress notes, where in most cases, this is the norm as temporary custody is a very short period of time, 72 hours. And I'm aware of the need to use that correct language moving forward. Regarding this complaint, I've done my best to acknowledge that the voicing of concerns is appreciated, acknowledge the distress and Ms. Spiker's experience, and apologize where appropriate. I've completed a detailed analysis of the issue, engaged in the interview with the board reviewer, and answered all questions as in a timely manner, and provided all documentation and records. Measures currently in place with Spectrum to prevent discrepancies in DCS cases include ongoing mandated reporter training, child and family team meetings, coordination of care trainings, and reunification process trainings. While I share in Ms. Spiker's sorrow regarding Max being removed from the home, I fervently deny that myself or any member of the Spectrum team colluded, conspired, or secretly aided any state or community agency to increase the likelihood of such an outcome. On the contrary, we worked incredibly hard to keep Max at the community level and in the home, consistent with our policies. And any questions?
Thank you. Any board members have questions for Ms. Lane? All right, no questions. So thank you. You can go back. So now it's time for the board to discuss, and we ask that you do not interrupt. So I'm just asking my fellow board members if there's any discussion. That otherwise, I'm ready to make a motion. Okay. So I'm making a motion to dismiss the case based on the documentation that has been provided, that we have all reviewed, and the hearing the statements from the complainant and the licensee.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, both parties, for being here. And now we move to item 4A7, Damon Winter. And the complainant, if you can come to the front. Is that Mr. Rutger. Thank you. Good morning. So first, we're going to listen to a summary from board staff, and then you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. This matter was placed on the consent agenda based on the fact of reviewing the investigative record. There does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegations. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Any questions for Ms. Zavala from board members? There are no questions. Okay, so Mr. Rockier, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. I really only have 3 points. First thing I just want to say, as a licensed professional counselor, also licensed in this state, I take this seriously, and I want to be present throughout this whole process, even if it is being recommended for dismissal, and I want to be make sure that I'm available just to see the process through, and also for my own learning experience. I think most importantly, I'm relieved to hear that the allegations have not been proven. I understand that I only have part of the story, and that there is the investigative report and additional information that I'm just not privy to. But again, I want to say that I'm relieved that the concerns that were shared with me have not actually been substantiated. I think that's a good thing. At the very same time, I also do believe that the client's experience, based again on the information that I know, did appear to negatively impact her. And even if that was her perception, and there was other factors, again, that I'm not aware of, that did just seem to negatively impact her. And I think that that should be taken into consideration. And again, even if the allegations were not proven with clear and convincing evidence, I think that this is a learning experience for all involved. The concerns that were shared with me were concerning for me as another licensed professional. And even if it's not going to proceed to a disciplinary consent agreement or disciplinary action, I think that there's an opportunity for a learning experience here. And I would recommend that either a letter of concern or a non-disciplinary consent agreement for some continuing education or just some other measures just to ensure that that learning process actually takes place rather than just dismissing outright without any further action. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for the complainant? Okay, no questions. Is the licensee, Damon Winter, present? Okay, the licensee is not present. So you can go back. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the board members have any discussion on this item? Or anybody wants to make a motion?
Just to put on the record, when we're looking at the consent agendas, we have to look and see if it rises to clear and convincing. And so that's what we're looking at. So just for the public to understand why we're making decisions that we do.
Thank you. Does anybody have a motion?
I would make a motion to dismiss based upon not rising to clear and convincing.
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Now we move to agenda item 4B. Cases recommended for dismissal with letter of concern. We have item 4B3, Candace Wilson. We are tabling that item due to quorum. And now we have 4B1, Christopher DeFranco. 4B2, Delilah Hall. And do I have a motion to recommend for dismissal with letter of concern, items 4B, 1 and 2?
Palacios.
Trotter, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next, we go to item 4F1. These items are cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. Noel Lande. Do I have a motion to approve the proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement for Noel Lande?
Palacios moves.
Miller, second.
Roll call, please.
Christina Groves?
Aye.
Crystal Krueger?
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera?
Aye.
Adelisa Meek?
Aye.
Dominic Miller?
Aye.
Diane Palacios?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter?
Aye.
Thank you. Next on our agenda are cases 4I, cases recommended for release from consent agreement. So I have a motion to release items 4I 1 through 5.
Go ahead. So moved, Trotter.
Palacios second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And now we'll move to agenda item number 7. Agenda item number 7, this is the time and place scheduled for board reviews of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by us pursuant to the authority given by ARS 323281. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice which included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach deliberation. This list is not exclusive and there may be other options that the board considers. Board members have reviewed all of the materials submitted for each case. The board first hears a summary of the cases from board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking do not take time repeating information that the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will collectively be given the same amount of time that the board staff took to present the case, or 5 minutes, whichever is larger. Once the board has heard from the parties, we will move into deliberation. We ask during this time that you do not interrupt, as it is our time to talk amongst ourselves. If it is necessary at any time to refer to a client or former client, please use initials only, including if they are the complainant. Please keep in mind that the board has a civility policy that prohibits disorderly conduct, and those in violation will be removed from the meeting. Before we begin, I want to advise everyone that this proceeding is being recorded. Accordingly, it is important that everyone speaks loudly and clearly and that only one person speaks at a time.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Ma'am. Polly over here. Could we just take a second? I think we're having some technical.
Okay, sure.
Get it out. Oh, you got
Thank
it?
You
okay,
so
great.
Much.
Never mind.
Just we're good?
Sorry.
All right, yep. Thanks. On agenda item number 7, we have 7G, Kimberly Kreisel, and 7E, Jessica Hedgepeth, that we have to table due to quorum.
You said G and what?
G and E.
Okay, thank you.
So the first item we're going to address is 7H, Harley McHugh. Is the applicant present? Okay, come to the front. And is that Mr. McHugh?
Yes.
It is.
Am I saying it right, McHugh?
It is.
All right, thank you. So first we're going to listen for a summary from the board staff.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, for the record, could we have Mr. McHugh introduce himself, being that he's presenting the applicant?
Yeah, my name is Martin McHugh. I'm Carly's attorney.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, Ms. McHugh is an LAC applicant. Jumping to the analysis, an applicant for licensure must meet all requirements of ARS 323275, which includes the following. A5, not have committed any act or engaged in any conduct that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action against a licensee pursuant to this chapter. And A6, not have had a professional license or certificate refused, revoked, suspended, or restricted by this state or any other regulatory jurisdiction in the United States or any other country for reasons that relate to unprofessional conduct. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following. ARS 323251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. And ARS 323251-16CII, making any oral or written misrepresentation of a fact in any statements provided during an investigation or disciplinary proceeding by the board. This recommendation is based on the following. Between 5-1-20 and 9-14-21, applicant was licensed as an LAC. From 3-20 to 6-21, applicant was employed with agency as a primary therapist.
In 621, applicant was terminated from agency due to messaging a patient through social media and making a purchase on behalf of the patient. On 8-2021 and 8-2421, two complaints were submitted alleging applicant was engaging in an inappropriate relationship with a former client. On 8-26-21, applicant signed a consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of her license, admitting to having a sexual relationship with the former client to whom she previously provided behavioral health services. In 7-23, applicant submitted an LAC application. Applicant answered yes to the background questionnaire relating to her previously surrendered license. In her explanation for affirmative answer, applicant noted the following. In 5-21, applicant held the position of intake coordinator at agency, and she was not working in the capacity of a therapist. During that time, applicant assisted with client, and her role involved coordinating with client's probation officer. Applicant never had a therapeutic relationship with client and was never present during any of client's therapy sessions. Applicant reasoned that because she did not act as client's therapist and he had not been a client of the agency for several months, the risk of there being a dual relationship or harm was relatively low. Although the relationship was not romantic or sexual at the time, applicant contemplated whether she wanted to subject herself to a full investigation into the allegations. A review of the client's clinical records showed he received services from agencies starting in 5-21 and was discharged in 7-21. Applicant was documented as client's primary therapist, and records show applicant completed client's assessment, facilitated group sessions, and provided individual therapy sessions. This can be seen in client's biopsychosocial assessment signed by applicant on 5-17-21. On 5-24-21, applicant and client met for a psychotherapy session to discuss treatment goals and assignments. On 6-2-21, applicant facilitated a group session where client attended. On 6-8-21, applicant and client met for a psychotherapy session where client discussed his plans, hopes for the future, and relationships. It is highly concerning that despite having provided documented therapy services, applicant denied being client's therapist and having a therapeutic relationship. Furthermore, applicant's own therapy records records provide a timeline of her relationship with client. A 7-18-21 progress note indicates that applicant went to California with client. A 7-31-21 progress note mentions applicant is adjusting to being in a new relationship with client and they are together at her place. Applicant's termination, client's documented discharge, and the start of the romantic relationship occurred within the span of approximately 1 month. Given this time frame, it would appear applicant misrepresented by stating there was a low risk of a dual relationship or harm because client had not been a client of agency for several months. It is also concerning that following the revocation of her license, applicant continued her relationship with client until approximately January of 23. Applicant represented the following during her investigative interview. After a complaint was made, it started to get more involved. Applicant figured she had already lost her license. Applicant now realizes the reasons for the rules, and they are not only to protect the clients, but to protect the people in the profession. Additionally, applicant answered no to the application background questionnaire regarding terminations despite having been terminated from agency. Applicant represented the following during her investigative interview. Applicant did not remember providing individual therapy to client. Applicant understands how she was misrepresenting now, but she did not intentionally misrepresent. She previously did not have evidence and went by what she thought and remembered. Applicant can now see her response to the background questionnaire questions were inaccurate, and she apologizes. In addition to entering into a romantic relationship with a former client and continuing that relationship for almost a year and a half, applicant misrepresented herself in her application and during the investigative process. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Avala. Any board members have questions for board staff?
Thank you.
No questions. So, Ms. McHugh, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Good morning, members of the board, executive director, and investigative members. Thank you so much for taking the time to look at my case and hear my statement. First and foremost, I am deeply sorry for disgracing the profession, the board, my family who is here today, and finally myself. This is undoubtedly the biggest mistake of my life and my professional career. I was 28 years old, and it has changed the trajectory of my entire career path. I'm not here before you apologizing because I got caught, but because I truly understand now the hurt that I have caused. I've always wanted to be a therapist, and I have this deep desire to help people through not only their worst parts of their life, but as well as support them during the best times of their life. After graduating from graduate school, I had this picture in my head of what my first job would look like and envisioned a clinical with communicative and collaborative environment, offering support and growth and development while providing the best care to our patients. Unfortunately, that was not my experience right from day one. I had sporadic meetings with my supervisor as she was on medical leave frequently and on vacation. So I was left to sort of run things myself. This in no way excuses what follows, but gives you insight to the environment that I was in. I know I am responsible for myself and my actions, and by no means am I making excuses for my behavior. You could argue that I just finished grad school and the exam, and I should have known better about the therapist and patient code of ethics. However, the environment was chaotic and very unstructured. I truly did not believe I was the client's therapist. Since then, and through my employment with Southwest Behavioral Health, counseling school-aged children, and other agencies, there are processes in place, a positive and collaborative environment where I have learned the true definition of a client and that it doesn't matter if it's 1 minute or 10 years. If an individual was in my care in some capacity at an agency in which I am employed, they are a client of mine. I now have structured meetings, open door policy, and questions are always encouraged. I am learning. I am completely aware that the ethical codes are there for a reason and that they are not only in place to protect these clients, but to protect us as professionals. I understand that regardless of threats of horrific abuse I suffered at the hands of the client and the context of the relationship, it was my responsibility to shut it down before it ever had the chance to escalate. I'm not proud of what I did and can assure you that I have been punishing myself for the past 3 years. I understand that empathy got the best of me and that my thought process was solely focused on the individual and helping him, but I just see how naive and inappropriate it was. I'm not a bad person. I made a grave mistake, and I must live with the consequences of my actions every day. But I have learned so much about myself and the profession throughout this process. I have been taking steps to educate myself, learn from my mistakes, and work to be the best version of myself. I continue to go to therapy twice a month and will be completing an 8-month curriculum with Grand Canyon University in August in health psychology. I am also involved in my church. I have attended these monthly board of behavioral health meetings both in person and listen to recordings and understand more about the ethical codes and the ethical misconduct that can happen in this profession. I am part of the American Counseling Association and have taken multiple ethics and boundaries courses. Through everything, I've maintained a strong family support. I understand that you may never see me worthy of possessing a license, but I assure you that this type of behavior is not a pattern. It was one mistake that will continue to make me better going forward. And if given the opportunity, I would do everything differently, and I would only represent the board in the highest of standards of professional conduct. I have matured. I implore you to consider my application to reinstate my license. It has been almost 3 years of very hard work since the signing of the consent decree to prove that I can contribute in a very positive and meaningful way to this profession. I ask, will any amount of remorse, education, therapy, prayer, or compliance atone for this very poor decision? All I can say is I'm truly sorry for everything and that I wish it never happened. I am blatantly aware of how I failed this board, how I failed this profession, and failed myself by allowing myself to stray so far from my true character. I am a good person. I follow the rules, and I can make a difference if given the chance. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody has any questions for the applicant? Okay, no questions for the applicant. So this will be our time to deliberate, and I believe Ms. Palacios, you're leading the discussion. So we ask that you not interrupt.
Thank you, Ms. McHugh, for being here today and all the hard work and intentional work you've put into yourself over the past few years. So we appreciate you being here. With that being said, just to have some discussion, it's when you know, you see somebody that's put in this much work, it feels hard to make these decisions. But when we look at the statutes and the rules of Arizona, in Arizona is a, you know, it's a no relationship with a client state, no sexual relationship with a client state ever for a license. That's what we need to look at. So just want to kind of put that on the record. I don't know if anyone has discussion or has anything to add. I'm prepared to make a motion. If anyone else has anything they'd want to say.
I think that we also need to remember that, you know, clients are vulnerable population, right? And it could be that the damage that a situation like this costs a client, you know, not just during the relationship, but, you know, it could be damaging for a very long time. if not like forever. Mm-hmm.
So I'm prepared to make a motion to open a complaint for impaired judgment and misrepresentation based in our ARS 32-3251-16L, engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice in the licensee's profession, and ARS 32-3251-16CII, making any oral or written misrepresentation of a fact in any statements provided during an investigation or disciplinary proceeding to the board. And so that would be my motion. There's a second part to it. Ms. Savala, should we go ahead and do the second part?
Well, the first part is to open the complaint and find for the violations, yes. And we have a motion on the table for that.
Okay. Second, Trotter.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Do I oppose? And now the second part.
The second part is based upon Arizona's laws and rules to deny the license.
Do I have a second?
The motion would be deny the application for unprofessional conduct.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That would be my motion.
Do I have a second?
Second.
And roll call, please.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Crystal Krueger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. So this concludes the matter. And if you have any further questions, you can reach out to the staff. Thank you. Next item on our agenda is 7B, applicant Julie Crotty. And is the applicant present? Okay. So first we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, Ms. Crotty is an applicant for an LAC. An applicant for licensure must meet all requirements of ARS 323275, which includes the following: A5, not have committed any act or engaged in any conduct that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action against a licensee pursuant to this chapter. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation: ARS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to ARS 32-3286, unlawful practice, unlawful use of title, violation, classification, civil penalty, exception. Factors for the board to consider: on 1-4-24, applicant submitted her LAC application to the board. Upon review of her LAC application, applicant indicated she was employed as a counseling intern at Agency 1 from 8-22-22 to 12-9-23 and a life coach at Agency since 12-12-23. Agency 1 and Agency 2 have the same exact address and are owned by supervisor. Board staff subpoenaed applicant's employment records with Agency 1 and Agency 2 as it was unclear how applicant transitioned from a counseling intern to life coach practically overnight. Supervisor provide a response to the subpoena, which included the following in part: from 8-1-22 to 12-9-23, applicant served as an intern at Agency 1 through her university. Upon completion of her internship, applicant provided a letter informing her clients that her internship was ended on 12-9-23. While awaiting licensure, applicant continued as a life coach to 6 clients, starting on 12-13-23. It was made clear through an informed consent to clients that coaching was not counseling, and the limitations of coaching were made apparent. Applicant provides coaching services through Agency 2, which is a separate entity from Agency 1. A blank Agency 2 coaching informed consent included the following in part: the therapeutic relationship is unique in that it is highly professional and at the same time a contractual agreement. The services to be provided by applicant are coaching as designed jointly with client, and the standard fee for a 50-minute session is $140. Even though supervisor represents that applicant transitioned to a life coach, there is nothing within her employment records with either Agency 1 or Agency 2 that clearly identifies the transition to life coach, such as a job offer letter, employment contract, or job description for a life coaching position. Applicant represents that supervisor informed her of the idea of transferring counseling clients to coaching clients when she was aware of her internship coming to an end. Applicant acknowledged not receiving any education in her master's program around life coaching, but has a certification in life coaching. Once applicant became a life coach, she ceased maintaining progress notes for the coaching sessions, so it's unclear what the topics of conversation included during that coaching. Applicant represents she understood she could not diagnose or use psychotherapy modalities with coaching, and the coaching included goals, strengths, and a focus on problem solving. It is unclear how overnight applicant transitioned from a therapist to life coach and proceeded to transfer at least 6 counseling clients to coaching services. Furthermore, applicant acknowledged that once she obtained her LIC, she would have offered her coaching clients the option to transition back to counseling, making it appear that this coaching service was offered to circumvent board rules by allowing applicant to continue providing behavioral health services without a license under the guise of a life coach. And just as a form of a note, after this matter has been concluded, board staff would like the members to consider opening a complaint against the supervisor, Amanda Higginbotham, who is an LPC, who allowed and encouraged this conduct to occur. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you. Do any board members have questions for Ms. Zavala? There are no questions. So if you can please introduce yourself on the microphone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. I'm Michael Rang with the law firm Bozen and Snow on behalf of LAC applicant Julie Crotty.
Okay.
And we thank you for your time. We know that you've read our submission, so I'll be brief, and then Ms. Crotty has a brief statement to make as well.
So you have up to 5 minutes, right?
Okay.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Okay. We'll be brief. You know, as an attorney, I was lucky in this case that shortly after Ms. Crotty hired me, we were informed by board staff that this board had recently considered a very strikingly similar case of an LAC applicant that was instructed and counseled by his supervisor too, that he was able to engage in life coaching. And so we have the benefit of hearing your discussion and the specific concerns that you had. And that helped us prepare our response to inform you of what we thought was important. And just to very briefly summarize that, the one element that we take exception with in the board's investigative report is that anything happened overnight. We think that this case is favorably distinguished from that earlier matter because there was a clear effort to distinguish life coaching services and psychotherapy. It did not happen. A new entity was established. Ms. Crotty was certified in life coaching. She informed her clients that she was ceasing psychotherapy and provided resources and referrals to other therapists. She also engaged in oral discussion and written discussion with the clients to supplement that. Before beginning life coaching, you've heard the reference to a new informed consent document for life coaching services, and you heard some of what's in that document, but in addition, it also said that coaching is different than psychotherapy. Any fair reading of that document would reflect it was absolutely intended to educate the clients that this is a new thing, this is different. And Ms. Crotty is available to answer any questions about the therapy that she provided as an intern and then the services she provided as a life coach, but in the interview, she described that she did not use any psychotherapy modalities. There was no intent to disguise psychotherapy as life coaching. But nevertheless, I don't want any of that to detract from Ms. Crotty's clear understanding of the board's concerns, and I would like to stop to give her moment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi to the members of the board. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your time. I apologize, I'm a little nervous, but really do thank you for all that you do for the Board of Behavioral Health and especially in the state for protecting clients and those that behavioral health professionals serve. When I decided to seek out a master's degree in counseling, I did so not only because of my interest in human behavior, but also because I really do have a deep passion to help others and to give back to my community in that way. I do take responsibility for my actions during my internship and then during my time as a life coach. Although at the time I did believe that I was making an informed and positive decision, I do understand now, after hearing the board's concerns, I do understand that it was not the right decision to make. And I did take action. once I understood the board's concerns and how my actions as a life coach could be, I did take action to stop seeing clients as life coaching. I'm no longer seeing any clients as a life coach, and I don't plan to in the future. I have learned a lot during this experience, and I plan to take what I've learned and really apply that going forward if I were to get my LAC. And really, my goal is to do no harm to clients, and I really want to do right by this field and to go into this field and be a trusted and respected professional if I'm given the chance. So, thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Anybody else has questions for the applicant? So. You want to go ahead?
You can go ahead.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions. So first, when were you aware or what made you decide to get that certification for coaching?
When I was presented with the option of this being an option to do life coaching after my internship, I decided to get certified. So I had some guidelines to go off of when I was providing coaching, knowing that it was a different service. It needed to be a different service.
Okay, thanks. My other question is, actually I have two more, I'm sorry. is there coaching available to people at the same practice? Or were you kind of going to be the first one? Is there any other clinicians in the practice that offer coaching?
No.
Okay. Because what I'm thinking is, as we're doing therapy, all of a sudden, because we can't continue to do therapy, now we invite people to do coaching, right? If the person is, or if coaching is recommended for somebody, how come coaching was not recommended at the beginning? Right? Because there's two different things. So that's kind of like what I was wondering, you know, why people all of a sudden are why we're recommending a different modality when we have been providing therapy, right? So when we do an intake, we kind of assess if, you know, if this is going to be meeting their needs. Mm-hmm. And so we go along that way. But then suddenly when we can't continue to provide that, now this other service is supposed to meet their needs. So that I was confused about that. I appreciate that. Thanks.
Yes. So my question is, in your situation, can you explain how it may show up as a dual relationship or your understanding of a dual relationship in this situation?
Yeah, I think, at the beginning, when I did make this decision to become a life coach and offer those services, I did not think of it in that way as a dual relationship, but I do understand a lot better now. And after hearing the board concerns and hearing the similar case, that it absolutely can be seen and can serve as a dual relationship. And I know that that is not appropriate or allowed and not in the best interest of clients. I do take that concern seriously now. At the time, I did not know or think of it as a dual relationship. I thought of it as providing a different service.
Thank you.
Any other question for the applicant? Okay, so now will be time for us to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. And Ms. Palacios.
Yeah. So we're seeing a lot, but we're seeing multiple similar concerns arise. And just putting it out there for professors that are teaching their students to take note of this and to talk about coaching, therapy, how it's different, how it is a dual relationship, for supervisors, for interns, for folks that are in school, for licensees, that if you're providing therapy to a client, you cannot then go and switch to life coaching. It's considered a dual relationship. It's, you know, if you're providing therapy, you're the therapist, and that is it. That's the boundaries of the relationship. If they're appropriate for coaching, absolutely refer to somebody else who can do the coaching. Same way, if you're a coach and a therapist, if you're seeing somebody coaching, you can't switch them over to therapy. It has to be you know, very strict, tight boundaries. So wanting to put that on the record for everybody, and as this is coming up a lot, to just be aware of that, and then the board looks at this, is looking at this and looking at it as seriously. So, so with my colleagues having the discussion, and seeing that, Ms. Crotty has learned from this, I wanted to hear from you today. So thank you for being here today. I wanted to hear from you today before we really, made a decision on which route to go. I think that holding the supervisor accountable is, we definitely need to do that and hold supervisors accountable because they are more seasoned and have been trained and know. So that's something that I want to look at after we make some decisions here. But just wanting to see, are we wanting to go the route of complaint or entertain NDCA?
If I may just add to your comments, this is very concerning because I think that the least, like a situation like this is not what we want. Somebody brand new from school, right, to get into the profession with such misguidance from a supervisor that, you know, as a student you look up to, and then you're totally misguided, you know, and honestly, sometimes you don't know better. And so this case is very concerning, and from the guidance of the supervisor, in my opinion, a lot more than, you know, the actions of the applicant. So
agreed. Yeah. And again, just interns, people that are in school, getting your license, just really understand what the guidelines of having a license is and understand it. Don't just rely on somebody else, because we've seen time and time again where people have been steered in the wrong direction and not given appropriate guidance. So really know. And if you have questions to ask the board, ask board staff. But again, know and look at the statutes, look at the rules, look at, you know, to understand what's within the jurisdiction of your license and what you're able to do and not do.
And don't forget about your professors, right?
Right.
If you're in an internship, you know, just keep that communication with your professors as far as what, you know, you're doing and, you know, how you're moving forward. So,
yeah.
I think we have
it. Yeah, we've
summed it up.
We've said it. Yeah. So colleagues, thoughts on going, you know, and as we see this, I'm hoping that we don't continue to see this as we're putting this on record, we're stating it in public. This is the second one that we've discussed, I think, in the last few months. And so are we wanting to the route of NDCA? Are we wanting to go open a complaint?
I think first we have to decide on the applicant. The right,
yes,
Ms.?
That's what I'm talking about.
No, the first thing you need to decide on is whether or not you want to open up a complaint.
Right, and okay. That's what I'm trying to decide, and I want to hear from everybody before just making a motion.
And if we don't open a complaint, Ms. Zavala, what happens?
You would just, there would be no action.
Okay.
There would be no memorialization either.
Okay, so, yeah.
So we couldn't do an NDCA route?
No, in order to do a non-disciplinary, you would have to open up a complaint. So you could open up a complaint, and then you can dismiss it with a letter of concern.
Okay.
Or you could dismiss it with an NDCA, but we have to open a complaint
to address
forward.
This. Okay, Perfect. So I would motion to open a complaint and continue to have discussion.
Second, Trotter.
All right.
All in favor?
All in favor?
Sorry.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye. All opposed?
Oh, none opposed. Okay. And now, what are we going to do?
I want to hear from all you all.
Okay.
So, because I have, you know, I can go either way. I want to hear from you all as well before.
I've been debating between dismissal and dismissal with letter of concern. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm thinking dismissal is because it seems like from the applicant's actions, she took actions to make sure that the clients knew that the consent, you know, and that they had an option. But then again, you know, moving somebody from therapy to now coaching makes me think of more of a letter of concern.
I think we need to do something to memorialize it,
yeah.
Rather than just dismiss. I think there's some, so I was thinking more NDCA, but I think if, you know, anyone else have any thoughts?
I was thinking NDCA because I would like to see it memorialized and then we could, yes, further discuss what remedies or stipulations we would want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But that, to the point of the supervisor, that's kind of weighing on me as well, because as somebody who's newly entering into the field and not having that experience,
mm-hmm.
Does play into it. But I would be more on the side of the NDCA, more supportive of that.
Yeah.
And, that. The non-disciplinary is so that there could be prescribed.
Yes.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah,
thanks.
I
had to say something, though. I think from a public standpoint, I think I understand where you guys are going. But I will say this, though. If you're going for a professional license, it is incumbent upon you to know what your first license is, junior or senior. So in this position, it is very important for you to know your scope, to know what you can and can't do. So I'm kind of uncomfortable with just the NDCA. I mean, it's a problem for both the supervisor and, you know, and the applicant. So I have a problem with both. Just because somebody tells you to do it doesn't mean you do it. If my manager, I'm in lending, but if my manager says do this and I'm uncomfortable with it, it is upon me to say, no, I'm not comfortable. That doesn't make sense, or to get a second opinion. So I don't feel like there's a lack of second opinion. I double check my manager all the time.
I agree with that as well. I think kind of coming from this position and reflecting on what it was like when I was an associate level, many years ago, and how that felt. I think that, you know, when we have supervisors, it's important to remember that while they do have experience, they are not perfect as well. And they are not they are not all knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes remembering that it's important to network and talk to other individuals in the field and really kind of make that informed decision for yourself, because at the end of the day, it is your license that's on the line, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I come from like a very like perspective of always protecting my license, right? No matter what, that's extremely important because it's our livelihood and it's our importance to protect the license and protect mm-hmm. the clients that we treat,
hey,
right?
Yeah. So sounds like we are in agreement.
Yeah.
Anybody want to make a motion?
Madam Chair, no. To interrupt, I would appreciate 1 minute.
We can't do that.
No, but Madam,
yeah.
But Madam Chair, if I could step in just because I want that clarity, and I think there's something that's important to consider is that, you know, the memorialization of conduct is always really important. That's one of our jobs. But I also think in this particular case, we really need to think about the small time frame that this, you know, occurred, the support from the supervisor. I'm a big agreement that I think the applicant should have known better for a variety of reasons. But I think as a board, we really need to make sure that we, and it's harder for the newer members, we need to look at all of the cases. You know, we have some really egregious cases where they do this for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And likely they won't get a license. And then we have others that are interns and just quickly flip to, you know, kind of circumvent while they're waiting to get licensed. It's not okay. It's not appropriate. It's not right. We don't want to encourage it. But do we want to put discipline on somebody's license forever because of that slip up? So I just kind of want to state that for the record. So I think, you know, you've opened a complaint, you know, based on what I've heard, you know, a letter of concern, you know, in regards to knowing the rules and the statutes, or, you know, an NDCA, which is also a dismissal, which is also a non-disciplinary for education. I think this has probably been very educational for her. But I just wanted to make sure that I put that in there just based on what Mr. Trotter said, and just because I just want to be mindful as a new applicant coming in. We need to look at the egregiousness of the conduct.
Also, Madam Chair, if I may add just briefly, conducting the meeting is within the realm of the board chair. Board chair may determine to allow somebody to speak at any point throughout the meeting. So it would be entirely within the board chair's discretion.
Thank you. Is there anything else that we haven't discussed?
I'll say this.
We may have a question.
I'll say this. You know, I was more before our executive director spoke, I was more upon the disciplinary side, but I'm comfortable with a non-disciplinary. I'm not comfortable with a dismissal. I'm not comfortable with a letter of concern. You should know this. You just got out. You should know this. But I am comfortable with the NDCA. So that's where I'm at this point.
Well, I would make a motion to for an NDCA, and then we can discuss what we'll go in, what CEUs we want to be in the NDCA.
I think you probably should continue that discussion now in regards. So you're looking at
before
an NDCA. Education,
okay.
Do you feel would be beneficial?
Okay. So please feel free to jump in.
The scope of practice. I would say law and ethics. Would be huge.
Okay. Scope of practice, law and ethics.
Are we talking about 3 hours?
Three hours of each. Boundaries as well, that can live within law and ethics as well, I think.
Yes.
So you said 3 hours scope of practice, 3 hours boundaries, and 3 hours of what was the last one?
The boundaries will be within
the ethics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other recommendations? No? All right. Well, that will be my motion then.
So what we would be offering her then is a non-disciplinary consent agreement for 12 months. Within that 12 months, she would be required to take 3 CEUs in scope of practice and 3 CEUs in laws and ethics to include boundaries. And if not signed, denied for unprofessional conduct.
That's my motion.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Oppose? I have parentheses. Is there early release?
There's always early release if they complete all of their education.
Okay. So, go ahead.
I don't wish to do dispute you're holding. I do want to know, would these need to be
I was going to
in
say
person
that I'm
because I do want to let you know that Ms. Crotty does plan to move out of the state, which would, I mean, she could take an in-person course.
We'll take care of that in just a second.
And all I wanted to say before was that in the matter that you resolved very recently, which had occurred before at a time Ms. Crotty couldn't have been aware of it, you did resolve that case with a letter of concern. In that case, there was no distinction between therapy and life coaching. There
Madam
was
Chair.
None of these elements.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we need to be very mindful. This was, the matter's been concluded. Be happy to provide education on what this looks like. But to give that additional comment is not something that we do for individuals. So with that said, you will get the non-disciplinary consent agreement will come to your office. Once it's signed by you, you then can get your license. The consent agreement will then get executed, and then you will have the opportunity to complete the education. And just for the matter of record, since it was brought up, I just want to be very clear to the public that the board members are tasked with a really big responsibility, and that is to look at each and every case a little bit differently. And so I think that in some cases you may have similar type circumstances, but the public doesn't always have that 100-page report that our board members have that they may be considering action on. And that's all I have.
Thank you. So the motion carries unanimously.
And I would also like to make a motion to open a complaint on the supervisor.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Motion carries as well. Thank you very much. Next is agenda item 7C, Sarah D'Amico. Is the complainant here? No complaint. Are you the complainant? Oh, you're the licensee? Okay, come to the front. Thanks. So first we're going to listen to a summary from board staff. Summary.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 3232516M, engaging or offering to engage as a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 8 of 22, licensee has been a school social worker at school. As a school social worker, licensee was not providing direct psychotherapy services. Licensee represents she would meet students regularly to address issues students may be facing. In this case, regarding student, licensee represents she filed a DCS report based on student's disclosures and wrote a letter under the guidance of DCS. A 5823 letter written by the licensee addressed to whom it may concern included the following in part. Student has disclosed disturbing information about complainant over the past 5 months. Despite licensee reporting these disclosures to DCS, complainant's lack of cooperation led to the case being closed. The letter included numerous statements that licensee represents for direct representations from student. Student represented that complainant ranked her as the third most important person in their life. This ranking suggests that complainant prioritizes his cat over student, which raises questions about his care and attention towards student. Licensee believes that complainant's words and actions are inconsistent and suggests that mother be granted full custody. Licensee suggests that if complainant wishes to pursue shared custody in the future, he should complete parenting classes and a program for better intervention domestic violence beforehand. Licensee represented the following during her investigative interview. DCS told her that some of the disclosures were outside of their statute of limitations and the best way to get the disclosures into court was through a letter. Licensee informed mother of this, who then asked licensee to write a letter. Licensee was aware this letter would be used in court. Licensee did not consult with the supervisor prior to writing this letter. Licensee acknowledged not having any sort of direct observation of student interacting with student, and it was based on student's reports. It is highly concerning that licensee provided an opinion that complainant should engage in his own services if he wants custody and that mother should be granted full custody when licensee, in fact, did not have direct observations of complainant's or mother's parenting of student. Furthermore, licensee acknowledged that the general notes she would maintain for student that are protected by federal law were very general and did not document the specific disclosures that licensee mentioned in her letter to DCS. Licensee and her attorney do not know whether DCS has a statute of limitations, but licensee represents DCS informed her they would not follow up on reports if the abuse happened too long ago. It is concerning that licensee represents DCS informed her of a statute of limitations when neither licensee nor licensee's attorney or legal department of school could furnish proof of statute of limitations regarding DCS's authority to investigate reports of child abuse. Licensee acknowledged writing one other letter in her career similar to the situation and further acknowledged not having much experience in writing letters. The letter licensee wrote is wholly inappropriate by providing her professional opinion based simply on students' representations without having any direct observation or knowledge of what student was disclosing. Additionally, licensee inappropriately inserted herself into legal court matters outside the scope of her licensure. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any questions from board staff? No questions. Okay. Could you just please introduce yourself on the microphone?
Yes, I'm Lisa Ann Smith. I'm the attorney for Ms. D'Amico. I'd like to speak briefly, and then she will also speak briefly.
You have up to 5 minutes combined.
Yes, understood.
Thank you.
So I just want to address just a couple of those issues. There's really no dispute about the fact that she wrote the letter. I mean, you've seen in the materials that she acknowledges that she wrote the letter. She was trying to help the student, but she recognizes that in making a recommendation about what the father needs and also about the custody arrangement that she was going beyond her own expertise and knowledge, and that she learned that lesson and will not do that again. So I want to just quickly address a couple of the things with regard to the DCS statute of limitations. Just to be clear, that's not being relied upon by Ms. D'Amico as a defense. It's just an explanation of why, how it came about that she wrote the letter when she spoke to DCS. That's what she was told. Whether that's true, false, or, I mean, we're not relying on the truth of that statement as an explanation. It's just like, why did she write the letter? Because the DCS worker told her, we're not going to look into all these things, but if you want to try to help her get it into court, you might just be able to write it down. So that's what she did after speaking to the mother. And the second concern about that her notes were not specific enough to really support the things she put in her letter, but as is states in the letter and in her response, before she gave the letter to the mother, she did review them with the student, and the student said, yes, these are the things I told you. This is all completely accurate. So with regard with, I mean, those are really the facts. Like I said, she wants to speak briefly. And I just want to ask you too, when you look at the factors in the regulation about what you would want to consider in terms of discipline, she doesn't have any prior discipline. She's learned a lesson. She cooperated. And we'd ask that you would dismiss the complaint.
Thank you. I just want to be very clear that while I am a licensed master social worker, I am not in an LMSW position. I am not providing therapy or counseling services to anyone. It is much closer to that, the career of like a guidance counselor is closer to what my role is in the school. I would also like to state that it was included in the investigative report, but the legal counsel for Tucson Unified School District did state that I did not violate any ethics codes of the Tucson Unified School District, any of their rules, and I do not have any disciplinary action from the Tucson Unified School District where I'm employed.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for the licensee? Okay. No.
Actually,
yes. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sure.
Wrong in my brain.
All right.
So you're a guidance counselor. How is this relationship formed with you and this student? Because I'm kind of confused to how we got all this information.
So, okay. So I was really confused too. So I was hired under the ESSER grant in a brand new social work position. Tucson Unified School District had previously had social workers who were part of your exceptional education department, and they service all of the IEPs, and they are providing therapeutic services. I am not. I was hired by my school site, not by the exceptional education department, and they hired me on because it is such a high needs area that the counselors could not keep up with it. And so they decided that they would like to have someone who was dedicated, who could meet with students, who did not also have the pressures of things like scheduling, going into classrooms, things like that. And so then at the beginning of the school year, I introduced myself to all of the new staff. Some of the children, the students came to me because they were referred by teachers. Some come to me because it's a referral within our system. I can see their past history and I can see, hey, this kid might need some support. It's literally like the teacher says, hey, I think this kid needs to be checked on. That's it. It's not like a referral.
Okay.
If that makes sense. It's like the teacher shoots me an email. Can you check on so-and-so? And so then oftentimes once I've had that first meeting with a student and I have that rapport, as they struggle with different things, they come to me then. So the majority of the discussions that I had with this student were not because I was going to the student. The student is coming to me to discuss what's going on at home.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have some. So based upon what you said, the student's coming to you, is that within the, would that fall in the realm of psychotherapy, right? You said clearly earlier that I'm not providing therapy, mm-hmm. but if they're coming to you with their problems or coming to you, then do you then refer out to another therapist and say, mm-hmm. okay, so you do that. Okay. So that was one of my questions. The second one is, what is your career plan or what are you wanting to continue in the school system or what are you wanting to,
I am planning on continuing in the school system. I have my LMSW because my school system does have a supervision program to become an LCSW. However, it's a completely different process. It's where we go and we find kids, we talk to the parents, we have signed consent agreements, goals, all of that. But that is not what I was doing with this student. And if I had been, I obviously would have had all of those consent agreements. Okay. And I do want to be clear about the reason that I don't have a lot of documentation. It is because where it is stored in the school system, everyone has access to those and everyone can see it. It is also because in the state of Arizona, parents have the right to receive all documentation regarding anything with their child's name on it in the school, which would include any and all disclosures that the child made. They would not be protected.
My next question is, do you have somebody that you go to for supervision or to consult with when, so if you're getting asked to write a letter like this and you're like, ooh, this feels a little sticky, I'm not sure, like.
So at the time, no, because I was a brand new person, everyone else in my school district had a mentor, which I found out later that even my principal and my office manager were new. They had mentors. I did not. And the principal who had actually hired me was no longer there. So she wasn't even there to tell me what exactly she needed me to do or anything. Now I am aware of our social work department and who is the head of that. And the woman who would be my LCSW supervisor, I'm also aware of who she is. And so in the future, if anything like this came about, I would, of course, go to them first. But at the time, I wasn't really sure of the things that were put in place. And my only direct supervisor was my principal, and she's not a behavioral health worker.
Right. And you weren't gaining hours towards your independent license. Are you wanting to? Is that your plan?
Yes.
Okay.
I do have a question. So when you wrote the letter, the last paragraph where you're giving recommendations, right, about the dad and custody, what was the intention of those sentences?
The intention was to protect the child from the severe reactions that she was having. Quite frankly, she was terrified of her father and to be there with him. And it was based on the different disclosures that she made. However, in anything, I would never include an opinion like that ever again in a letter.
Thank you. Any other questions for the licensee? Okay, so this will be our time to deliberate, and Ms. Palacios.
Yeah. So I think just to put on record again, in regards to writing letters for DCS or court or anyone, as a therapist, as a licensed therapist, we only know what we know. There's so much that else that goes on in cases that we're not privy to. And so writing letters and making recommendations really falls outside of our scope unless we have specific training for that. So I just want to say that. And then I am prepared to make a motion to open a complaint with this, but I'm willing to hear. So I'll make a motion to open a complaint.
Hold on a second. I will discuss if you don't mind.
Yeah. Just for the record, we have a complaint open.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is more of a question to my professional members, just because, you know, based on the presentation, the materials, to me, when I look at this letter, I mean, I don't like it, but I feel like if the professional didn't use her credentials and says, you know, counselor or something like that, this would even be here. So I feel like this is a little bit different than the other historical cases we have seen. And so my question is, I guess, to the professional counselors, to our professional members. If this person, because, you know, I think, have we established that, you know, this professional wasn't providing services to the, so that, you know,
to psychotherapy.
Psychotherapy. Yeah. So I guess, so my problem is that, you know, she wasn't providing services to the person. And so I'm like, I don't know if it rises to the level of complaint to me. Do I like the letter? No. But I don't know if complaint is the appropriate level for me, considering all the other circumstances and evidence in this.
I'm thinking that the outside of the scope of our license, mm-hmm. I think, is the issue, not necessarily outside of the scope of our current job. It seems like her position, the school wanted somebody licensed, from what I understand, right? And so the letter.
Verify that.
Right now. Hold on just a second. So it seems like we're looking at scope of our license, if am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think that's something the members need to think about. As a board, we regulate somebody with a license. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not providing psychotherapy, they have to be above board. Mm-hmm. So when you have an individual that's signing a letter that's making recommendations with their license, it actually rises to a little bit higher level The intent usually when you're using your credentials is to get the attention of somebody that you have experience as a licensed master social worker. So I think in this particular case, even though psychotherapy wasn't being provided, it might be a little bit different, but is it a little bit different? You know, she was using her license, collecting and gathering information and making recommendations based on that. So it's that scope of the license, okay, whether it was appropriate that that was done.
And recommendations about somebody that the licensee never saw, and recommendations about custody, which is way outside her.
Right. Oh, I agree. To me, the problem with the letter is that she put their credentials down. And then, I mean, I think it's. And then that the school wanted a licensed person for this particular job. Those two things didn't weren't in here. I would not be in support of disciplinary at all, but understood.
Thank you.
Right.
Any other discussion or you ready?
No, you all said what I was, you know, what I was thinking.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would make a motion then to find for violation of extending boundaries of competence. ARS 3232516M, engaging or offering to engage a licensee in activities that are not congruent with the licensee's professional education, training, or experience.
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? And what are your recommendations?
Recommendations would be to have three CEUs on boundaries and roles, boundaries, roles, and relationships. Have three CEUs on high conflict families and how to respond in court or DCS / collateral context. The reason I asked the question about if she's planning on obtaining her LCSW is to add the supervision piece. And so I would like to add supervision but she would need to be providing psychotherapy. So maybe once psychotherapy starts, then add the supervision piece. Is that doable?
It's doable, but it could be problematic for her because if you require that she get clinical supervision and she maintain this position for several years,
right,
she would maintain being on that consent agreement. The only thing that we've done in the past, if the board members felt that clinical supervision would be very beneficial, you could put it as a stipulation in there, but put a caveat only if she's providing psychotherapy. In other words, a year from now, if she's not providing psychotherapy but has done everything else in the consent agreement, she could still request release. But that's only if as an LMSW, she's going to acquire hours for license, or she's going to have clinical mm-hmm. supervision.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would like to add that. And also
to add the supervision.
Why?
With the caveat. If she decides to do psychotherapy, to have the supervision.
Oh.
Can I just say that I actually can't.
Thank you.
I can't without because of this matter, I can't get insurance. So I actually cannot pursue my LCSW in any way, shape, or form. So I just wanted to make that clear that I can't do that until this is
okay. Raina, please don't interrupt. Thank you. You were saying, Mr. Trotter, you asked like why?
Well, so with the caveat, I'm like, okay, that's fine. It's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just, if she does pursue psychotherapy, then to have the supervision, but
at the same time, executive director says if she's going to go for those hours, she's going to need supervision with those hours. So isn't it
redundant?
Possibly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. We don't have to add that. Just a thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other part that I was thinking is ethical decision tree making or ethical decision making.
Would that be like under like ethical boundaries, CEUs?
Yeah.
It's usually included, right?
Yeah. And are there CEUs specifically an ethical decision tree making model, like making decisions, like making ethical decisions, or that falls within ethics as well? And then I was going to say restrict supervised private practice, but it doesn't sound like she's going to go that route anyways, but I would like to just put that restriction on there. That would be my motion. If anyone else, does anyone else have anything to add?
No, I don't have anything else. Anybody? No. Ms. Zavala, do you get all that?
So we would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. 12 months, you'd be required to take three CEUs in behavioral health ethics to include boundaries and decision-making model. She'd also be required to take three CEUs in high conflict court cases or high conflict families. Mm-hmm. Let's remove the court because it could be either.
Yeah.
And then there'd be a practice restriction of no supervised private practice. And then if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
Can we also add attend a board meeting in there, please?
So we will also be adding to that motion to attend a 5-hour board meeting.
And then that would be my motion.
Do I have a second?
Trotter, second.
Roll call, please.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Crystal Krueger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Adelise Amik.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. So if you have any further questions, you can contact the board next week. Otherwise, they will be contacting you. All right. Thank you. We're going to take a 5-minute break, so we'll be back at 10:35. Mics on, please. The board is back in session at 10:37, and our next item is 7A, Jacqueline Battle. The complainant here? No? Okay, so Ms. Jacqueline and Mr. Goldberg. So first we're going to listen to a summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to R46-211, direct supervision. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 3-2-20, licensee has been licensed as an LMSW. During her investigative interview, licensee represented she worked at various clinics and group homes since obtaining her license. This included at least 6 facilities, including ART and Good Samaritan. Licensee represented the following in her written response. Contrary to the claim, she received supervision from Metronomics while working at ART. Licensee subsequently provided a 321 outside supervisor contract and clinical supervision notes ranging from 321 to 1021. Clinical supervision notes included the following in part. A 3-4-21 note where supervisees shared information about their agency, the population, experience, and they processed the client. A 4-12-21 individual supervision session noting licensee came prepared and presented several cases with needed details. A 10-21-21 individual supervision note indicated they discussed cases in depth and therapeutic approaches for them. ART is owned by licensee's husband and business partner. Licensee represented the following during her interview. Licensee worked with ART for a few months but does not recall the dates. Licensee's role was more or less like a supervisor in that she handled scheduling, handled day-to-day operations, and helped clients get what they needed. Licensee did not really have any clients but received clinical supervision. She worked as a support for other therapists and completed intake assessments and treatment plans. Licensee sent the clinical supervision notes as proof she was supervised because it was alleged she did not have supervision. Despite licensee representing she did not have a caseload of clients, she was involved in the client's clinical care. It is also suspect that licensee initially represented she received clinical supervision at ART, supplying clinical supervision notes appearing to correspond with this employment, and then represented she did not provide therapy services while working for ART during her interview. Licensee represented the following as well. Licensee did not really have a direct supervisor at ART. If she had questions, she would talk to business partner or sometimes husband. Licensee did not have a direct supervisor at Good Samaritan. Licensee was receiving supervision from supervisor, and she did not know that direct and clinical supervision were different things. It's highly concerning that licensee worked at multiple facilities, one which was owned by her husband, without direct supervision as an associate-level licensee. Of further concern, the clinical supervision contract licensee and supervisor utilized did not outline the behavioral health agency the supervision would occur for. The contract was signed by husband as the CEO, licensee, and supervisor. Licensee represented the following. The contract that was submitted for Metronomics was for ART, as that is where the relationship started. Licensee utilized this clinical supervision contract for work done at approximately 4 other facilities, and she did not have other contracts for those facilities. Husband did not have ownership of the other facilities where licensee provided therapy services. It is highly concerning that licensee was utilizing a contract originally meant for ART and signed by husband for other facilities he did not own. This would indicate licensee did not have a valid outside clinical supervision contract for approximately 4 facilities she provided services in. Licensee also represented working with ART from 8:20 to 5:21. It does not appear licensee had an outside clinical supervision contract at the beginning of her employment with ART between 8:20 to 2:21. Furthermore, licensee represented that she was employed with Good Samaritan between 4:20 and 7:20. During her investigative interview, licensee represented the following. She was the only licensed therapist at Good Samaritan and the only one providing therapy. While licensee worked at Good Samaritan, she received clinical supervision from supervisor. It is concerning that licensee would represent to receiving clinical supervision from supervisor in 2020 when the clinical supervision contract was signed in 2021. It would appear licensee either misrepresented her dates of employment or about receiving clinical supervision from supervisor. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to R461101, consent for treatment. This recommendation is based on the following. Licensee worked at ART, which was owned by husband. Licensee represented working at ART in a supervisory role. A review of ART's consent forms, they were missing six minimum requirements. Licensee represented the following during her interview. She did not create the consent forms for ART. She is not sure who created them, but she did look at them. Licensee did not know the consent forms were deficient. It is concerning that forms from an agency owned by licensee's husband and reviewed by licensee did not meet all minimum board requirements. And that is all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for staff? No questions? So do you want to introduce yourself on the microphone, please?
Yes. Mike Goldberg. I'm going to take just a few seconds of our 5 minutes. Ms. Battle did have a supervisor at one time at one of these facilities, and then that supervisor left, and she should have stopped, and she didn't, and she's going to explain that. And as was mentioned by the investigator, the consent form was not created by her, but obviously she has the responsibility to make sure that it's proper. But she wants to address you and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Good morning to each and every one of you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I am extremely nervous, but I'm also extremely excited for this opportunity to speak to you all. And the reason I'm excited is because, you know, I'm just honest and direct and blunt, you know, and I will admit my fault and my wrong. And that is something that I'm not proud of. You know, I've already repented before God. So I'm excited that I get to admit that before everybody so that I can have a clean conscience, because that's important for me. But just to give you a little bit of background, I have been social worker since 2006. I got my master's in 2007. When I first joined, becoming a social worker was really to be able to help people. And that's my heart's desire is just to help and to provide a service. And that's my life's purpose. After this experience, to be completely honest, it has really opened up my eyes to value my license more, to value the statutes and the rules and things of that nature. So I've been looking to become a licensed therapist for many, many years. So when I became licensed in 2020, I was very excited, you know, to be able to provide that service. And I moved forward. I know 2020 was a very different year for all of us. That's when COVID began and a lot was happening. And I'm not making an excuse. I'm just kind of sharing from that time frame up until now. A lot of it was blurry, you know, so a lot of it wasn't clear as far as what I needed to do and what the rules were. I know now, and I haven't been operating that way lately. You know, I work under an agency and I have appropriate consents, appropriate supervision. So during my investigative interview, I was honest and I said I did have gaps in supervision. And the reason I have gaps is when I had a supervisor and then that relationship ended. Now in hindsight, I should have stopped seeing the clients, but due to the state of our world and the stress that we were experiencing, I was still seeing people face to face, not even virtually. And I know that people needed that contact and they needed that support and help. So that's why I made that decision. Now looking back, it was a poor decision and I apologize for that. And moving forward, I will make sure that I, you know, abide by the laws, the rules, the statutes that's in place to protect clients and also to protect myself and the value of this license that I have. So I hope that you guys, you know, can hear my heart that I'm not proud and I'm, you know, embarrassed by making that decision back then. But moving forward, you know, the value of my license, not just for me, you know, I heard somebody say earlier is our livelihood, For me, I get, yes, a livelihood, but for me, it's purpose. It's bigger than a livelihood. This is what I've been called to do, and I want them to maintain that ability to continue to impact people. And we look at the documentation that was provided. A lot of my supervisors say that I'm compassionate, that I care for the people, that I'm good, a good therapist. So I want us to be mindful of the good work that I've been doing, and it was for the clients, you know, that I did it, and not making an excuse. And I didn't sincerely apologize for not upholding, you know, the honor of what the rules were. So thank you guys for this opportunity. And I hope that you can hear my heart and accept my apology so that this day forward, I can move in such peace and with a clear conscience, because that's important for me.
Thank you very much. Any board members have questions for the licensee? No questions. So we go to Ms. Palacios.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, I do have a question. I'm sorry. I just want to know, what have you done so far since this investigation started to ensure that you follow the rules and the law?
So since this investigation started, just reviewing the rules and reviewing the statutes and code, and even in my investigative interview, I was able to learn even more information. So I have really taken the ownership, which I should have done in the beginning, because it's my job to know the rules and, you know, the regulations. And I didn't. I was very ignorant, and I apologize for that, and I'm honest about that. But now, since then, I really know, you know, the rules as far as direct supervision, supervision, and having that clinical oversight, you know, supervision, and now knowing what goes into a consent of that nature. So being able to educate myself and be aware from this day forward what is required of me, and having that awareness within myself and even any job that I work with from here on out, if I don't feel like they're honoring that or doing that, that I would definitely speak up and do what's right.
And this review of the rules is by yourself? You're reading the rules, or are you consulting or discussing with anybody?
No, so just, yes, on my own, just reading the rules. And then, like I said, an investigator, being able to talk with someone who knew, you know, the rules, and being able to learn in that space as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? No. Okay, Ms. Palacios, do you have the discussion?
Yeah. Thank you for being here today with us, Ms. Battle. So as I was listening to you and reading the report, something that I thought about was sometimes as supervisees, we may not know what to expect from our clinical supervisors, and I think that that's shown up multiple times. And so I'm prepared to make a motion, but just wanted to say that on record. And one of the things I was thinking about too is having anyone who's licensed, if you're planning to be a supervisor or not, can take the clinical supervisor training to just understand what's expected from a supervisor and understand what you need and what you deserve as a licensee. And so that would be something that as I was reading your case and that I thought about. So I am prepared to make a motion if no one else has any comment. No. Okay. So I would motion to fine for violation of practicing with no direct supervision, ARS 3232516II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to R4-6-211, direct supervision, supervised work experience, and the documentation deficiencies, ARS 3232516II, violating any federal, state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to R4-6-1101, consent for treatment.
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Thank you.
And so as we're crafting this consent agreement, one of the first things that I would want to put on there is taking the 12-hour supervision course, so you understand what you would expect from a supervisor. And so you can understand that and what is needed from the supervisor perspective and also the licensee perspective. And then some three CEUs on documentation, on Arizona documentation. And let me go backwards really quick. For the clinical supervisor training, specifically an Arizona clinical supervision training, someone that is out of Arizona. So then that way you know what Arizona expects because it is different across the states.
Is Palacios saying the 12-hour or the...
The 12-hour.
12-hour, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And the reason I think for 12 hours, it just, it's more robust and you can really you have a more comprehensive understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Something else I'd like to add is to attend a board meeting. And I was going to say restrict supervised private practice. And then thinking about also of supervision. So I believe the licensee is currently under supervision. Do we want to make that documentation a focus? I mean, after hearing her today, after I think having the training on supervision, doing those CEUs, I don't know if we need to add specific supervision other than what she's doing for her license. Thoughts?
I don't think we could add, but we could probably ask to incorporate, right? Instead of adding additional supervision, that the supervision that she already has, no?
We have to have a way to to mandate it, to monitor it. I mean, I think she's here and is probably hearing the concerns of the board. And I think the, you know, with the extra education that she's taking, hopefully that would be included.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking as we're here today. Mm-hmm. So that would be my motion, unless anyone else has anything they would like to add.
So let me go ahead and read it back. We would be offering the licensee a consent agreement for 12 months. She would be required to get 12 CEUs in clinical supervision training specific to Arizona. She would be required to get 3 CEUs in Arizona documentation. And she would be required to attend a board meeting for 5 hours. There would also be a practice restriction where she couldn't do supervised private practice. If not signed, she'd be invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
That is my motion.
Can I add something?
Sure.
Can we add law and ethics in there? CEU for ethics? Units?
Yeah.
Law and ethics or
just ethics?
Just behavioral health ethics. Okay.
Yeah.
So 3, and we'll add to that motion 3 CEUs in behavioral health ethics.
Miller second.
Roll call, please.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Crystal Krueger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Anton Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. So that concludes the matter. If you have additional questions, you can call the board and board staff will get back to you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
We do need to modify. I apologize. I was trying to catch you, but I couldn't figure it out in my head. We need to modify the violations. The motion was to fine for 16 double I as it relates to R46211, mm-hmm. which is correct, but there is an error in the report. The second 16 double I should be P, so it should be 16P1101.
Thank you.
So if we could modify that motion and basically just redo the motion to fine for the violation of the 16 double I, but then P would be the second one as it relates to the 1101. Apologize for that.
No, I propose to modify the motion to add the P violation.
As it relates to 1101.
As it relates to 1101.
That works.
Miller second.
And do we need roll call again?
That one could be a voice vote, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry?
Just a voice vote.
That could be a voice vote.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Good luck. Next on the agenda is item 7F, Jason Kramer. And I believe it's going to be on the phone.
That is correct.
Hello, is this Mr. Jason Kramer?
Excuse me? Is this Mr. who?
Jason Kramer?
Yeah, Jason Kramer, that's correct. Who am I speaking with?
All right. My name is Adalisa Meek. I'm the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's chairperson. We are here to address your issue. And just to let you know, this is a public meeting. It is being recorded, and I am sitting here with board members, board staff, and members of the public. So first, we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff, and then you will have an opportunity to address the board. You'll have 5 minutes to do so. And so then we're going to deliberate. And at this point, we're going to get started with the summary of your case from board staff. And I ask that you put your phone on mute. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, and Mr. Clare, this is Toby Zavala, the executive director. This matter is coming before the members today for the members to consider opening up a complaint on Mr. Clare based on the information that is in the report that's before you today. Before I begin, I just want to be very clear for the record. There is a lot of confidential information on the licensee that is within this record. And so I will not be bringing that information up as it's been clearly recorded in the documents that are before you. I also want to remind you that this is just to open up a complaint, which is going to allow us the opportunity to further investigate, meaning that Mr. Clare is available. The board members will likely want to hear from him, but it's not a time for us to investigate because you don't have a full investigative report before you. I'm just going to, again, briefly go over the information since all of it you have and you've read before you. In February of 2024, we did receive a self-report. That self-report was in regards to two criminal charges. I also want to make a note that we also received an outside complaint on March 28th of 24, but board staff chose not to open up that complaint based on the fact that we felt that it could be dealt with throughout the self-report. In reviewing the self-report for the criminal background, we began to get some information that was directly submitted to us from Mr. Clare that rose to a level of concern for board staff. Particularly, I'll draw your attention to number three on the overview. Again, just briefly, it was indicated that he felt that there was evidence of someone in his house when no one was there. He also felt that somebody had hacked into his private practice HP printer that he just purchased and began setting up. There was multiple conversations between Mr. Clare and board staff throughout emails, and based on those emails, there was a concern that there may be some behavioral health issues that need to be tended to. We did offer Mr. Clare an opportunity of possibly going on a timeout where he could be like, you know, work on himself. With that said, we just had a very difficult time getting any information from Mr. Clare. We consistently asked for information and we were not provided it, which then required the board to subpoena our own licensee, which is very unusual. So we do have some of that information before you. And again, based on that information, I do believe the members should consider opening up a complaint. Also would like the members to possibly consider offering our licensee an interim consent agreement, which would basically suspend his license while he gets the help that he needs for his behavioral health. Additionally, we'd like the members to consider issuing a comprehensive psychiatric evaluation based on the evidence that's in the report. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Any board members have questions for Ms. Zavala? Okay, there are no questions. Mr. Crater, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay. They never offered me a timeout, and I gave them ample information. Michelle Rassi subpoenaed my intake documents from Sage Counseling before there was a formal complaint open. That's pretty much it. And subsequently, they have never asked Sage for any of my record updates. So I've been to 12 group counseling sessions now, and they've never asked Sage for a single document. So if there's concerns about my behavioral health, why haven't they requested more of those documents from Sage? I believe that the board violated my civil rights and what they did. And I'm willing to, once you issue the complaint number, I look forward to getting a lawyer and undergoing whatever psychiatric tests you guys feel necessary. That's it.
Thank you. Any board members have questions for Mr. Carrera? Okay, there are no questions. So now it's time for the board to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. Mr. Miller?
Yes, thank you. I am ready to make a motion if anyone else has anything to add. So I would like to motion to open the complaint.
Bless you, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
All right. So second, I would like to, I'm ready to make a motion as well in terms of the next steps. So I'd like to make a motion to offer the professional an interim consent agreement and issue an order for the professional to submit a comprehensive psychiatric evaluation. And if it's not signed, if the ICA is not signed, the licensee will be invited to remand to a formal hearing.
Last year, second.
Roll call, please.
Christina Groves?
Aye.
Crystal Krueger?
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera?
Aye.
Adelisa Meek?
Aye.
Dominic Miller?
Aye.
Diane Palacios?
Aye.
Antoine Trotter?
Aye.
Thank you, and this concludes this matter. Board staff will be getting back to you. Mr. Krueger, and you're free to go now. Next on our agenda is item 7I, Drew Peace, and I believe he's going to be on the phone. Is the complainant here? No complainant.
Hello?
Yes, is Mr. Drew Peace?
Yes.
Hi, my name is Adalisa Meek. I am the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners chairperson, and we're getting ready to address your matter. And just a reminder that this is a public meeting. It is being recorded. I am sitting here with members of the board and members of the staff and also public members. So first, we're going to listen to a summary of your case, and then it will be your turn to address the board. So if thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the board, following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation. ARS 32-3251-16II, violating any federal or state law, rule, or regulation applicable to the practice of behavioral health as it relates to ARS 13-3620, duty to report abuse. This recommendation is based on the following. Since 10 of 15, licensee has been employed as a clinical supervisor and therapist at agency. A 6518 clinical supervisor job description within licensee's employment records included the following in part.
Excuse me. Mr. Peace, can you put your phone on silent, please?
Yeah, I muted it.
All right, thanks.
His job description included the following in part. Monitoring of staff members' clinical documentation through ongoing compliance review to ensure that the staff members maintain adequate written documentation, provide direct clinical supervision to staff members on an individual basis as well as in a group setting using a coaching and practice demonstration approach, review and sign off on all clinical documentation, immediately report to the executive director any incidents of questionable or inappropriate conduct by self or other agency staff for investigation. Since 5 of 23 licensee has been therapist clinical supervisor at agency 1, an 8/21/23 intake assessment completed by therapist included the following in part. Mother stated she called PD and DCS and they decided mother would take care of it herself. Regarding the sexual contact with his sister, client reports the first time was when he was 10 years old and the victim was 7 years old. Client reports he continued sexually molesting her for years and he knew what he was doing was wrong but could not stop. Client reports there was one time he thought about victimizing another victim but stopped himself. Client self-reported that he sexually victimized the younger sister for over 5 years. Licensee and therapist signed this intake. There is no record or documentation of therapist or licensee obtaining proof of the PD or DCS report mother allegedly filed. Furthermore, there is no documentation or evidence that therapist or licensee filed a DCS report on their own. Additionally, an 8/22/23 treatment plan signed by licensee and therapist indicated that client was 11 years old when he began sexually assaulting his younger sister for a period of 2 years, and once again, there is not evidence that a DCS or police report was filed. A 9/28/23 telehealth group note by therapist included the following. During the conversation, therapist asked client his understanding of why he victimized his younger biological sister. Client was about 10 years old when he was exposed to sexual images. A 92823 clinical supervision note for therapist by licensee indicated the following. Discussed recent information obtained during session with client, which included sexualized behaviors. Therapist had followed up with the treatment team members, including the parents, regarding whether reports had been made. Therapist had documented all information regarding client's statements and information regarding what has already been reported to authorities. Licensee and therapist discussed the quality of care complaint that was received from the agency. They discussed therapist completing a mandated reporting training, and therapist will complete this training as soon as possible. A 10-23-23 telehealth therapy note by therapist indicated the following. Client shared with a description of his familial social relationships prior to victimizing his sister. Client stated he learned that he wanted to have sex, and that is why he victimized his sister. An 11-13-23 DCS APS police report incident report by therapist indicated the following. Date of report is 11-13-23. Date learned of the incident is 8-31-23. Therapist obtained additional information from client during an individual session on 8-31-23 and while talking to mother on 9-5-23. Therapist and licensee both signed this note, which appears to be the first note licensee signed within client's records. An 11-28-23 case management note by therapist indicated the following. Therapist reviewed client's clinical records and case notes prior to contacting law enforcement in Springerville, as requested by client's access provider. Reported an incident that likely occurred in 2016 when client was 12 years old. Client recalls at the time that the event and incident occurred at the home of a family friend that he shared with his wife and their two children. Therapist called Springerville Police Non-Emergency Line, and the dispatch operator asked therapist to provide the location of the incident, but therapist was not provided an address or location. 12-12-23 DCS police report incident report by therapist indicated the following. Data report was 12-12-23. The report was made to Round Valley Police Department. Officer Brian Holmes, badge number. Date learned of the incident, 8-11-23. Despite licensee's job description clearly outlining that his job duties included signing off on all clinical documentation, it does not appear he started signing off on clinical notes for therapist until 11-23. Furthermore, there are numerous notes within client's clinical records showing several conversations around the sexual contact he engaged in or facilitated with other minors. Additionally, licensee signed the 8-21-23 intake assessment and 8-22-23 treatment plan where client clearly discloses his prior sexual perpetration on others. The 9-28-23 clinical supervision notes clearly show licensee was aware that therapist needed to file a DCS report based on the disclosures from client. Despite licensee being aware that therapist needed to file a DCS report acting as his supervisor, licensee failed to ensure an appropriate report was made. It is concerning that over 2 months passed before therapist does in fact file a DCS report, and almost 3 months until therapist files a police report. As a mandated reporter, not only did therapist fail to file a mandatory report timely, but licensee failed to ensure himself that an appropriate report was made, being that licensee is a mandated reporter and signed off on the assessment and treatment plan where the disclosures were made. Being in a clinical supervisor role overseeing unlicensed individuals places more responsibility on licensee as well. And that is all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for our board staff? No questions? Okay, Mr. Pease, you can unmute your phone, and you have up to 5-6 minutes to address the board.
Thank you. So regarding the assessment that was assigned by me and the information that was included there, the entirety of the information was not presented in the board's summary of the case. In the assessment is identified that mom contacted law enforcement and DCS. Investigations were held. The investigations were substantiated, and then the cases were closed. DCS did everything that they were supposed to do. Law enforcement did everything that they are supposed to do. Yes, I did sign that document identifying the information that is in there. Logically, we would think that the reports were made. There is no requirement for us to challenge whether or not a parent actually made the report, nor is there a requirement for us to validate whether or not report was made. Mom said that she made the report. That's identified. The information is identified and it was followed through on. That was the 8-21-2023 assessment. The information that is pertaining to this case began on 8-23 in those case notes. Related to me, whether or not I was signing documentation, as related to Mr. Festin, my supervisee's position, he is under the regulations of ADHS, not under the Board of Behavioral Health. And according to ADHS,
per AZ Admin Code Title 9, Chapter 10, Section 9-10-1011. Behavioral health services and the guide to medical records compliance for outpatient specialty agencies, there is no requirement by ADHS or AAC that we sign off on or review every single case note. We are required to sign off on the assessments, which is what you see I have done. I did sign off on the assessment. The treatment plan that was cited does not contain any information about sexual abuse. It contains roles. That's what that has there. I did sign off on that as well. When we look at this code, again, we complied with the code that AZDHS put in place, that we sign off on the assessments, but we have no regulation to sign off on those case notes. It was identified that I began signing off on case notes in November for Mr. Festin, which is correct, because of this case, we identified that he needed additional oversight. When we were identified that there was no report that was made, we did everything that we needed to. We, meaning myself, as well as the agency, Agency One, we addressed the situation. As soon as we became aware that Mr. Festin did not make the report, we instructed him to make the report. We instructed him to attend a mandated training report as well. And then we consistently followed up with him whether or not he was making those reports. You are correct. There was a significant amount of time that passed before he finally made the report, but we never left him alone, not checking up on him. We consistently checked up on him, find out why he had not made that report and telling him to make the report. In my previous or my first meeting with Mr. Villarreal, he asked why it took so long. Again, supervising Mr. Festin, he told me that when he took the mandated training report, he believed that the training told him he did not have to make the report. I told him that was incorrect as his supervisor, making sure that he understood the training correctly. And I told him that was not correct, that he needed to make the report. That's why he did make the report after that point. We did not just leave him alone, and we did not just think there was no reason to make the report. We made sure that he made the report that was necessary to be made. Again, had I known about it, I would have told him, yes, make the report, the second that I found out about it. Mr. Festin never contacted me about the information or let me know what was going on until after the report or the complaint was made. As related to mandated reporting, ARS Title 13, Code 133620, Item 6 says any person who is employed as the immediate or next higher supervisor to or administrator of a person listed in the paragraphs above and who develops the reasonable belief in the course of the supervisor's or administrator's employment, expect that if the supervisor or administrator reasonable believes that the report has been made by a person who is required to report, the supervisor or administrator is not required to report pursuant to this paragraph. With Mr. Festin being a 17-year veteran as a clinician, when we assumed that he would be making the report, he consistently takes mandated reporting training. He should have made the report initially. I believe you are actually in possession of documents that state that he was going to make the report, not to me, but to other treatment team members for this client. Again, we had not received the information about this yet because he never spoke to me about it as his supervisor. I only know what the therapist is going to tell me. Because we have then told him, hey, you need to make this report, we had reasonable belief that he was going to make the report. When it was identified that he didn't, he was put on an additional performance plan. Mr. Festin has been put on performance plans. He's been put on development plans to address this specific issue. And we have increased clinical oversight of everything that he is doing because he's showed that he needs that. Part of the performance plan is it's a period of time. We're going to do everything that we can to monitor him until he shows that he no longer needs that extra monitoring. At this point in time, again, he's shown that he's needed it, so we're going to continue to do it as long as it's necessary. I do not believe that I have done anything wrong. I do not believe that it is appropriate to call my character into question and say that it's concerning that I am supervising people. I believe that I'm doing what I should be doing as a supervisor. We are in compliance with regulations as related to signing. Mr. Festin was attending group supervision. He knows he had access to me outside of scheduled supervisions as well. And once we found out that the report needed to be made, we did everything necessary to make sure that that report was made.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Festin. Any board members have questions for the licensee?
Oh, I'm Mr. Pease.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am so sorry, Mr. Pease. Anybody has any questions for Mr. Pease?
I have a question.
One question.
As supervisee, was it a BHT? So is that just what access or whatever ADHS decides is a BHT? So a person that has high school education, 3 years experience in behavioral health, is that what that person?
Well, I think.
Sorry, you're really quiet. Could you?
I'm normally not quiet. I'm speaking close to the microphone. I'm sorry. I was just asking for your supervisee. The question is, they were a BHT, so what level of experience did they have or education? What made them a BHT?
Yeah, Mr. Festin is not a BHT. Under ADHS, he's classified as a behavior health paraprofessional, or a BHPP. He has a master's degree in counseling.
Thank you.
But I believe for DHS, I don't like to speak on behalf of DHS, but I believe DHS for BHTs, you just have to have a high school diploma. It sounds like in this case, this particular individual has a master's in counseling, just isn't licensed.
Just isn't licensed. Okay.
Correct. He does. And he's been with Grossman & Grossman for, I think it's 15 or 16 years now as a therapist.
Thank you. Any other questions for the licensee? Okay, so if you can now put your phone on mute, the board is going to deliberate, and we ask that you not interrupt. Mr. Miller?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so based on everything I've read and heard from the professional, I do see clear violations here. I think that is apparent and convincing, and I am ready to make a motion to fine for the violations at this point, but I wanted to see if anybody would have had another take.
No, but just to put on record, if there is for DCS, if somebody does report abuse and say, oh, I have a report number, I don't know where it is, if they can't produce a report number as a licensed professional, we have the responsibility to make another report.
Okay, thank you. Well, I make a motion to fine for violations listed in the investigative report.
Plasio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. And any recommendations, Mr. Miller?
Yes. So I would like to offer a consent agreement for 12 months with continuing education. I have the 3 clock hours of Arizona law on mandated reporting of criminal charges, including duty to report, and then the 12-hour clinical supervision tutorial. But I'm open if anyone else has thoughts on something to add.
That sounds to address the issues.
Can we hold for just 1 second?
Yeah, hold on for a second.
But give me 1 second. And I apologize. We have a little issue over here. We do, and I should have brought this up earlier. I was trying to find something else out, but we do have a prior action on Mr. Pease. So before the board members deliberate on the stipulations, we're going to upload that for the members to review that. We do it this way because we want to make sure that you're reviewing the alleged allegation that's in front of you, not priors. But now that you have found for the violations, we're going to ask for you to look at the priors, consider if there's any other or different types of stipulations that you want to add based on the prior.
Yeah, and give me just 1 second. They were named the same. I just have to rename the file.
So I would just ask that you all take a pause and review it, and then when done, look up so that Ms. Meek knows that you reviewed it.
is the one?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. One check here. We do have hard copies on there.
You do?
So for anyone, if they had the thumb drive, we have a hard copy.
Oh. I'm good, thank you. Anybody need additional time? Okay, so thank you for that. Mr. Miller, you want to lead the discussion?
Yes, so in consideration of the priors, it looks like, I was originally thinking ethics to add that into today's consent agreement, but it looks like that was done and completed, and he was released off of the prior consent agreement. And so I'm looking to seek feedback from the board.
Do you think, I don't know what the prior ethics class was, but if it's, you think of an in-person application might be better, because most of the time it's online classes taken. So I know we've used that historically. If they have to take another class, maybe in person would be a little bit more receptive to that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think my concern is around the continuation of some of the violations in a relatively short amount of time. So I was actually thinking clinical supervision.
Well, I'm looking at the report, and in the previous consent, there was 12 hours of supervision training with a focus on ethical and legal considerations. So I'm concerned because here we are less than 4 years later with issues with supervision again, and that's already been completed as well as the ethics. And so I'm concerned about the licensee providing supervision since we've already had, you know, attempt for rehabilitation with supervision.
Did they meet the agreement recently? Like, it's dated November 2020. When did they, like, meet all the requirements?
They were released on 1/21/21.
21.
Okay.
That's
three-ish.
Yeah.
Three and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this new complaint's dated in what time frame of that, within that original complaint to this complaint? It's afterwards, obviously, but
yeah. What would your thought evolve into then?
Are we able to restrict supervision?
So anytime somebody's on a consent agreement, part of the stipulation automatically is they can't provide clinical supervision. So when they're on a consent agreement, they cannot provide clinical supervision. Now, with that being said, part of the consent agreement is you could have the consent agreement last longer where they can't provide clinical supervision.
And we could also ask graduate level courses versus CEUs.
Yeah. Yes, you may.
Yeah. That feels better than another 3 hour or 6 hour.
What does this say? Did he take the 12 hour supervisor?
He did.
Okay.
I would say we need to add like a graduate course on like law and ethics for sure, graduate level course. And then do they offer graduate level courses on supervision?
They do.
Oh, perfect.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Love that.
So I think that like requiring those two would probably be great. And then I guess the consent agreement does kind of take care of like not providing supervision. But I'd almost want there to be some sort of supervision over him as well moving forward for a period of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know what that would look like. If anyone has any thoughts.
Well, I have a question. So when this second investigation was done, did we look at when this person was employed and the PHT was employed, and was he providing any type of supervision during the time of the original, the other complaint? Now I'm wondering.
No.
That's not something that we would have done because we were only going to investigate the complaint that's before us.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just more or less curious, was he providing supervision to this person during the time frame that he wasn't supposed to in the first complaint that we're talking about, 2021? And if he was employed at that employer and that individual was there.
So let me clarify that a little bit, because the individual that he was providing supervision from is not licensed by us. It's a BHT. Mm-hmm. So when we stipulate you can't provide clinical supervision, that would be for somebody that's requiring hours.
So an oversight's okay.
Correct.
Got it.
Administrative.
I mean, you could practice restriction and you could put that in there, that they can't, you know, provide clinical oversight. But when we were speaking earlier, we were speaking specifically about clinical supervision. Okay.
I would like to add there's the restriction of not being able to provide clinical oversight as well as clinical supervision. I would feel more comfortable with that.
Or oversight of people providing counseling. Because there could be oversight to case managers for not providing therapy. But wait, that could be the same thing.
So do we want to do it overall? Cannot provide clinical oversight over individuals providing behavioral health services?
Yes.
Which would
Encompass
all that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I can, first of all, I can list out some of the modifications I'd like to make to the consent agreement. I'd like to extend it to 24 months. Add the graduate level course in ethics. The graduate level course in clinical supervision, and clinical supervision for him to receive that for 12 months. And frequency, I was thinking twice a month.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can we add no early release?
We can do that. We can add no early release.
Quick question for you. Typically, you know what? I think this one is okay. Never mind. Because you said that clinical supervision for only for 12 months and then education for only 12 months. But if you do it for 24 months, he still would be limited on his supervisor. So that makes sense. Sorry. Thank you.
Let me clarify something just to make sure. Because so if the consent agreement is for 24 months, he would be required to do all of his education within 12 months. Okay. If he gets released for clinical supervision after 12 months, that remaining 12 months, what are we monitoring?
Mm-hmm.
What we could be monitoring, based on what I've heard today, is that not providing clinical oversight. And you could request a quarterly attestation from their supervisor that they're not providing clinical oversight.
Let me throw a little twist here. If we're doing 24 months, what if we extend the supervision for 24 months, once a month, and then I just had an idea about like the oversight. Could we have the supervisor address and monitor the licensee's competency to go back to providing oversight? So release from not providing oversight as recommended by the supervisor. Did that make sense?
It does.
I don't know if I love that. I feel like I would still want there to be like a period of time that we're not providing oversight. Because ultimately, right, like there could be a way of now being able to provide oversight depending on the supervisor's decision.
So it could be 12 months, no oversight.
Oversight, and then followed by supervisor's
recommendation, discretion. Did that make sense, Ms. Zavala?
Yes, but then that would open up for an early release. That's what I'm trying to.
Not if the supervision goes for 24 months.
So the supervision will be for 24 months. Okay.
Once a month.
But the duration for the second year is up to the.
Okay. Whether they can provide the oversight?
Yes.
Okay.
Past the first 2 months.
So going back to the focus, duty to report, behavioral health ethics, documentation, statutes and rules.
That's it.
How about. Providing clinical supervision. I think I'm following what the intent here is. So we would be offering Mr. Pease a consent agreement for 24 months. In the first 12 months, he would be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics, a 3-credit graduate level course in clinical supervision. During this time, during the first year, he would not be able to provide clinical oversight to individuals who are providing behavioral health services. He would also be required to get clinical supervision for the entire 24 months, once a month. After the first year, the clinical supervisor can make a recommendation if he would be able to provide clinical oversight again at any time after that first year. But he would still get it monthly for 24 months, and the focus would be duty to report, behavioral health ethics, documentation, and statutes and rules.
That is my motion.
And if not signed, invited to a formal interview, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
Could we add, like, the supervisor to also provide supervision over his own supervision? Like,
he's
if he's released to provide oversight, right, then the supervision includes that part of the practice.
Supervision of supervision.
Which should be part of clinical supervision.
It should be.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That is my motion.
Palacio, second.
Roll call, please.
Christina Gross.
Aye.
Crystal Krueger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Pease. You're now free to go, and board staff will be reaching out to you.
Okay.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, item is 7D, Miguel Espinosa. And the licensee is not here, correct?
I do not know.
Is the licensee here? Mr. Espinosa? No? Okay, so first we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, just for the record, Mr. Espinosa was notified that the board members would be considering opening a complaint today based on information that we have received from various emails from Access and DHS in regards to possible fraudulent behavior. The information that has been initially collected is part of your report. Again, at this time, board staff is just asking you to consider opening up a complaint. Once that complaint is open, Mr. Espinosa will have an opportunity to respond to it, and board staff will have an opportunity to conduct a formal and full investigation.
Thank you. Ms. Palacios?
Yeah. So my motion would be to open a complaint and request additional information. Additional investigation, I'm sorry.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Do we need a roll call?
No.
Oppose? Thank you. Motion carries. And now we go to agenda item. So we go to 9, Ms. Zavala.
And Madam Chair, just to let you know, we're going to go ahead and do the rest of the agenda. All of our disciplinary matters are over. We are waiting for lunch to arrive, and then we'll take a break for lunch. We do have another matter that we aren't able to call till closer to 12:30 today, so that's why we're going to kind of do it a little bit different than what it normally looks like.
Okay. So item number 9. Applications for licensure, educational programs, review, consideration.
So since our last board meeting, we've issued 386 licenses.
Wow.
That's a lot more than other months, correct?
Seems to be
like in the 200s, and now we're in the 300s. Thank you for your work. Denials, please.
The Counseling Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 5 applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, 2 applications based upon the failure to take the required examination, and 1 application based upon the failure to meet minimum requirements, total denials equaling 8.
Do I have a second?
Second, Charter.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
So the Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 3 applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, 1 application based upon a failure to take the required examination, and 1 application based upon the failure to meet minimum requirements, total denials equaling 5.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Motion carries.
The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 4 applications based upon the failure to pass the required examination, 4 applications based upon a failure to take the required examination, 3 applications based upon finding unprofessional conduct, total denials equaling 11.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Substance Abuse Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 3 applications based upon the failure to pass the required exam, 1 application based upon a failure to take the required examination, total denials equaling 4.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And that takes us to item number... number 11, report from the treasurer, May financials. Do I have a motion to approve May financial report?
Palacios motions to approve the financial report for May.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Financials approved. Item number 12, Ms. Zavalas, report. Yes.
Madam Chair, at this time, if we can go to... Agenda item 12B, and this is an action vote. This is the 2025 board meeting calendar, which was uploaded to your portal. Generally, this board meets the second Friday of every month. On occasion, we modify it for particular reasons, such as a holiday. But it's important that our board vote on this meeting calendar, A, because it's in our law that says we need to every June. And then secondly, we want to be transparent to the public and make sure we post it on our website. So if I could get a motion to approve the meeting calendar.
So move, Trotter.
Palacio second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Calendar's approved.
I'll go back to A, update on board members. I guess this would be an opportunity for us to welcome our new board members. It was a pleasure doing their orientation with them. Excited to have them on board. Does anybody have anything they want to say as I put you completely on the spot?
I just want to say thank you for joining the board. We really, really appreciate it. And we're really excited to have a full board coming soon. We still have a couple of openings, but welcome.
Yeah, and for the public, we still have 2 public member openings. And if you have any interest in participating, feel free to reach out to me and I can give you some information on time commitments and what that looks like. Primarily a public member is somebody that's not going to have a conflict of interest with the board and what our board does. With that being said, you do have to apply through the governor's office, and the governor's office is solely responsible for the appointment process and the choosing of the individuals that get placed on the board. So welcome.
Glad you're here.
Yeah. You guys want to say anything?
It's an honor to be here.
Thank you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Everybody's happy that you're here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
And then monthly, we've had our 2024 sunset audits on our agenda. I can't share any of the information that's been given to board staff. It's really just on here as a spot in case board members have any questions in regards to the process. I will tell you it's been since December. I think it started last January. It's been super fun. It's been my first in 14 years. And I think we're going to have a final report next month. And what I can say, my out loud voice, is I think our board is going to be really proud of the work that we do. All right. Next, let's move on to the disciplinary matrix. And that was uploaded to your portal as well. I'm looking for mine. I'm not sure what I did with mine. So let me just tell you a little bit of history about this discipline matrix. First and foremost, it is required by the governor's office to submit a board-approved disciplinary matrix for all health boards by July 1st. I will tell you that's the sole purpose of board staff creating this for our members. I think that creating a disciplinary matrix for a behavioral health board is really difficult because you can have a case of a breach of confidentiality that can range from a dismissal with a letter of a concern to a revocation, depending on what that breach of confidentiality looks like. And so, you know, I just want to reiterate that this was something that was required. You're going to notice when you look at it, and I apologize, it is a little bit hard to see. We're still kind of working on that. But when you do take a look at it, you're going to see that it's kind of pretty general. At the end of the day, it's going to tell you that you can pretty much look at any case and do whatever it is that you need to do to rehabilitate or educate that licensee. This matrix will be available for our members in their binders each and every month. I think it's up to each member how they want to use it or if they want to use it. Board staff is not going to refer to it, and the only reason that we're not going to refer to it is because I think that our board does a really good job looking at each individual case, looking at the facts for each of those individual cases, as well as the mitigating circumstances that can lead to different types of disciplinary based on that information. Ms. Meek, I'm sure we've had some conversations about it. I don't know if you want to add a little bit more onto that.
So, yeah, I think that we need to be diligent in how we address each case individually, right? This is not a guide that says this is what we're going to do. This is kind of just like a foundation, right? And how we build on top of the foundation is going to be very individualized. So just to remind us that that's the reason why it's here.
Are there any other questions on that
or comments?
So I also consider this kind of a working document, meaning if, you know, any of our members, you know, have ideas, suggestions, modifications to it, feel free to let us know. I'm not going to say you should or you shouldn't use it. It's just really a guide. It's a tool for you to use. And I'm going to, you know, reiterate that I think our board has done a really good job over the years at making sure that we look at those cases individually and taking action on those cases. And I think that between our audit and between the history of the board, I think that it's publicized that our board does a really good job at that. But with that said, I do need to have a motion so that I can let the governor's office know that the board members reviewed it and are accepting the matrix as it is today.
So a motion to accept the matrix as is, Trotter.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Approved.
Now I'm going to jump down to I. So 12I is a discussion regarding the state of Arizona budget shortage. And when I originally put this on the agenda, I didn't really want to have a conversation about this. But just real briefly, for those members that were not on our board last month, just a little bit of history. Our board has an increase of about 39% over the last 4 years in licensees. I think it's a 99% increase or 101% increase in complaints. Obviously, more applicants, more licensees, more renewals, more complaints, same staff number. And so our budget last year we submitted for 2025, which starts July 1st, an additional 7 staff members. And at that time, we in January, when the governor initially put out the state budget recommendation, it was included, which was super exciting. 7 members for a 20-member staff is life-changing. And we were really excited about it and began to kind of get prepared for what that looks like, because we wouldn't be able to hire them until July 1st. But you can imagine there's a lot of other things that need to take place to make that happen. With that said, about a month and a half ago, I think it was, maybe 5 weeks ago, I don't know if you all read in the paper, but like we're like $8.9 billion short in our budget, which, by the way, did not happen overnight. For whatever you read, it didn't. It's been an ongoing thing. But now this year's state budget is supposed to fix that. And so basically anybody that asked for staff was told they couldn't get staff. They were sweeping the boards. They were taking monies from various agencies' appropriation. They put a hiring freeze on. They also put a pay freeze on. And, you know, as an executive director, and I think as our board members, that should be very discouraging and uncomfortable, because, you know, we're wanting to keep our staff. We're wanting to take care of our staff. We're wanting to retain our staff. And it's really difficult to do when you have no control over anything. So we're still kind of there today. However, Wednesday night, like at 9:30, a bill was heard with a new budget. And that new budget that's being considered actually today, it actually was considered yesterday. We weren't brought up, which is a good thing, but it's now being reconsidered today. Hopefully by midnight tonight, there'll be a signed budget. And that signed budget has 7 staff members in there for us.
Yay. Can we clap for your effort?
I mean, I think a lot of it was, you know, I think the governor's, that's one of her missions is behavioral health. And if you take away from behavioral health, it's going to be difficult. With that said, we're not out of the woods. It looks like they're going to take $4.2 million from us. It looks like we still have a pay freeze. We will be able to hire people. When we hire people and we promote staff to supervise people or we move them around, we'll be able to give increases. So that's a good thing. We just have to, it'll be fun to try to figure out what that's going to look like, but we'll figure it out. A lot of the big state agencies that are not boards are getting a 3.5% cut from their budget. So that's pretty significant as well. And then last but not least, we may be known as an 85-15 rather than a 90-10 board. So we're currently a 90-10 board. A lot of people don't know what that means. A lot of our licensees like to think that everything we do is really expensive and that our renewals are expensive and our applications are expensive, and they are expensive. But they're expensive because we don't get any money from the general fund. We, in fact, give to the general fund. So if our board makes $100,000 in a year, we have to give $10,000 to the general fund. As an 85-15 board, we're going to be giving 15% back. So I don't see it as being a good thing. And I think it's problematic on many different levels. And I've done everything I can to explain my concerns about all of that. But at the end of the day, those 7 staff members kind of outweigh all of those other really negative effects, in my opinion, because it's going to be able to get people licensed quickly. And it's going to be able to protect the public from those individuals that are bad actors. And we're going to have an opportunity to be able to process our complaints faster. So hopefully by the end of this evening, at least I will be celebrating. And anybody I choose to text really late at night, because I'm so excited, stand it. But it, again, it's life-changing. I mean, we are, and I'm sure other boards have similar type circumstances, but they don't have the growth that we have. And we are drowning in applications. And, you know, we have this hiring freeze and you can't bring anybody else on, but yet we're paying people overtime, which I guess sounds great, but then you have to worry about burnout and you have to worry about all of that. So it's a kind of a little bit of a juggle. So fingers crossed, hopefully our meeting in July will have some really good news and possibly some new faces. Clearly, we can't hire 7 on July 1st. Knowing me, we might have 6, but we'll see what that looks like.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
So considering that we might turn into, an 85-15, so essentially it seems like that the effect that it's going to have on us is more expensive for the licensed professionals when they renew, when they order stuff, pretty much expensive. I mean, those fees are going to go up to cover that, correct?
No. So our licensees fees won't go up. That would be like moving a mountain in Arizona.
Really? So how does that work?
It's, you know, maybe that's something we can maybe agendize and talk. I can have a little bit more of a collective thoughts that I could put together for you. But it's an interesting process. You know, here's part of the issue, and I'll say this as simply as I can. You know, it's very hard for us to figure out the revenue because of the increase. We don't know how many people we're going to have, right? We don't make a lot of money on our applications. We make most of our money, if you look at our budget, based on our renewals. And so it's very difficult to think, oh, we're going to make X amount of money this year. But at the end of the day, even if we make $3 million in a year, we're only allowed to spend $2 million a year. Mm-hmm. So every year we could possibly bank $1 million. I don't mean bank because it just sits there mm-hmm. for the governor's office to take it. So we have to live off of our appropriation. So every year when we develop our budget, our job is to get our appropriation as high as we possibly can so we can spend the money that the board is receiving from the outside.
Okay.
I'm sure there's a better way of saying that, but I didn't go to school for that. But it's complicated, though, and it doesn't seem right for our boards. And for them to take $4.2 million from our board, to me, they're taking it from our licensees because they're the ones that paid. In our budget this year, we asked for $2 million, and we wanted to give back to our licensees by their renewals, charging everybody like half or something. Mm-hmm. But we weren't allowed to do that. So it's not always easy to do that.
Interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions on that?
No, thank you.
All right. So just real briefly, discussion regarding legislative updates. There's just not too much more to say than what we've already said about the counseling compact. I want to say again, because I know there's a lot of people that listen to our audios each and every month, but the counseling compact, even though it's passed in Arizona, the counseling compact does not exist yet. That is a national organization, and until that national organization says it exists, it doesn't exist, which means we can't be a part of it. What we're waiting for right now is we're waiting for that database that all states talk to and talk with. Rumor is right now it's going to be January or February of next year. So our board is absolutely positively on it, but we can't do anything about it until that happens. Again, the bill passed where they're no longer going to be called substance abuse counselors. It's going to be addiction counselors. We're in the process of making changes to that. It won't go into effect until 90 days after the legislative season is over, which, again, might be tonight at midnight. There's also a scope of practice that was redefined as process addictions. So for addiction counselors, it's been limited to substance abuse addictions only. The definition is now going to include process addictions. It doesn't mean just because you're an addiction counselor that it's within your scope to treat gambling addictions. But if it's in your scope of competency, then you would be able to based on that. The social work bill might pass today. Does anybody in the public have an update on that? No. Mm-hmm. As of yesterday, we don't know. The social work compact, we might know today if there's a social work compact. Been trying really hard to watch them last minute, but they're now going into the evening because of the long days they have across the street. So I think now would be a good time. Just briefly, we're going to make some changes to our investigative reports. I'm just going to briefly touch on it, because three of our members are not here, and then we have three brand new members. I don't want to get anybody confused. But we are making some efforts so that we can process cases a little bit faster when we actually get to the board meeting. I say that because when we get seven more staff members and we have three more investigators, what does that look like?
More cases to process.
A lot more cases. This was a very short day. Most of our board meetings are going till three these days. So there has to be efforts on staff as well as our board members on what does this look like? What can we do to help? The consent agenda is something we did a long time ago, which helps a lot. But there's just got to be ways. So some of the things that we're going to be doing is, one, right now when you look at the board reports, there's an analysis. That analysis includes staff recommendations on violations and then the supporting facts of what gets us there. Moving forward, maybe in July, maybe in August. Jarrett and I haven't quite figured that out yet. We're also going to be putting recommendations for stipulations. So we're going to be maybe recommending clinical supervision for 24 months, you know, twice a month the first year, recommendations only. You know, I like to sit here and think, we've been here a long time. We hear you. We know a lot of times where we think you might be going. So just to help guide you through that process. And then in addition to that, Ms. Knapp is creating a tool that is almost completed. Maybe it is completed. And it's going to be a working tool as well. And what it's going to be is each of you are going to basically have what we'll call a case sheet, primarily to use for the cases you're assigned to. You could use them for every single one if you want, as you are responsible to read every case. But primarily for your cases that you're assigned to, you'll have a case sheet that'll just kind of help guide you on what you can do. Oh, I can do a practice monitor. I could make them do therapy. I can do biological fluid testing. So as you're going through your report and you're looking at staff's recommendations, you can then look over at your options. Mm-hmm. So that when we come to a board meeting, it maybe, hopefully, will, even if we save 5 or 10 minutes a case, we're going to need it. All right. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Plus, we'll have that tool in front of us next month. And I just encourage you, you know, I don't want to say especially our members that have been here a long time. I think even just our newer members, if there are things that you think that we can do as board staff or even as board members when we come to these meetings to make it easier, we obviously want to make sure the quality is there. We want to make sure we have all of the information when we're determining, you know, discipline. But is there, what else can we do to make some of the process go a little bit quicker when we get to the board meeting? Because, again, 7 new staff, 3 more investigators, could be up to 15 more reports a month. Okay. So
did you say 15? 15-ish.
I'm so excited to say that.
Well, it is because, you know, like bottom line, right? We want to process all those cases, you know.
And I think, and there's a lot of other things, you know, that I'm thinking about. You know, there are some cases that maybe board staff could offer ahead of time and get, even for discipline, offer ahead of time and put it on the consent agenda. We're just going to have to kind of work through it, you know, as we get it. Trust me, you know, 15 more cases here, that means 15 more cases that Jarrett's going to review and 15 more cases that Toby's going to review. So it's a lot. So we have to figure out what is that all going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
It may be, you know, in some cases it may be disciplinary action, and it may be that board staff does the violation, does the stipulation, and if they agree upon it, we can put it on the consent agenda.
Mm-hmm.
But we just need to make sure that we're comfortable that that's what our board members are going to want, because ultimately it's your decision. So anytime you can think of, you know, those types of ideas. All right. So next, let's go to F. F is an action vote, review, consideration, and possible action regarding the annual election of board officers, which is the chairperson and secretary treasurer. Just as a reminder, by law, this is something we do every June. For example, Ms. Palacio was just voted in as Secretary Treasurer just a few months back, but because by law we have to do it every year. So now would be the time. I also put it on the agenda last month. I realize the new members didn't see that, but I always put it on in May to let members be thinking about it, if they have questions, if they want to know what that role looks like, the time commitment, and so forth. But at this point, we are going to need a motion for a secretary or a treasurer.
I move to approve Ms. Palacios for the role of secretary for the next year.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Congratulations, Ms. Palacios.
I accept it, yeah. Yeah. All today.
That's not on my script.
Thank you.
Script. Thank you very much.
And then next, if we can get a motion for the chairperson.
Palacios moves to retain Ms. Meek as chairperson.
Trotter second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And I accept.
All right.
So the last thing before we break for lunch is going to be the rules. And again, this is an action vote based on law ARS 41-1039. So let me just share a little bit about what this looks like in general, that whole rulemaking process. And I'm not sure if I'm proud of it or not, but this will be my eighth one in 14 years. But the rulemaking process is difficult. And, you know, I'm just going to say that there's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of permissions that we have to receive. But at the end of the day, I think that it's a really transparent process. And it's really, really important for our board to be transparent through this process. As a board, we have a responsibility to make sure that our licensees are following the rules and the laws, but we really don't have that responsibility to, like, make up rules all on our own. We really need to be reaching out to the various associations, you know, on making sure that we're doing what they want to do for their discipline. And I say that because every time our board goes through a rulemaking process, one of the first things that we do is we have what we call a stakeholder meeting, which we typically have every quarter. And those stakeholder meetings involve our four professions: social work, marriage and family, counseling, and addiction counselors. And we just talk about, you know, what changes do they want to see? What do they want this to look like? What rules, you know, can we modify? What rules can we make easier to understand, to clarify, those types of things? So that's kind of how the rulemaking process starts. With that said, anytime statutes are changed and it affects our board, that's going to promulgate rule changes, right? And so just we received the first step that we have to make before engaging into the rulemaking process is approval from the governor's office. And again, mine's really small print and I don't see really well, so hopefully you guys can see it better than me. But in your upload, and I'll go through them really briefly, but in your upload was an approval that we requested of the governor's office. And I just have to say it again in my out loud voice. We requested on Thursday at 8:30 p.m. and that following Friday at 10:20 a.m. we got approval. So I think that that just denotes the support that we have from the governor's office and the relationship that we have with the governor's office. And with that being said, if you look at number one is basically a continuation of the 22-23 rulemaking. That one last year went almost all the way to the end. And there was a little bit of a hiccup. And long story short, we had to withdraw the rulemaking. So we are basically going to continue that. So for the public, and again, this will be a very transparent process. As the rules get posted, there'll be, you know, public hearings and so forth. But basically, that rulemaking will continue. We are going to be making changes to the one rule that held us up. And that was the for supervised private practice, every 20 hours of client contact, you had to have supervision. We were trying to change it to every 10 hours. And because of that one rule, we had to withdraw our entire rulemaking process. That will not be part of that rulemaking process. It's not on here, but out of transparency, the other rule that was removed from that rulemaking package was to require a clinical supervisor to be independently licensed for 1 year before they can provide clinical supervision. With that being said, taking those two out, we feel that, as we talked about last month, we've made some changes or some ideas to add into our rules so that we can do the exact same thing just differently. Mm-hmm. So for supervised private practice, we're looking at creating additional CEUs that are required that they can be used for the renewals, but the CEUs would be required for the clinical supervisor to have clinical supervision specifically on how to supervise a private practice. Mm-hmm. And then for the supervisee, they'll be required to take CEUs on basically how to open and own your own private practice in behavioral health. So we think that is going to help a little bit. I'm not sure that it's going to be the same as a 1-10, but at least it'll be a comforting feeling for our board that we've done what we can to make sure that they're getting that education. I don't see that as going to be an issue because they're going to be able to use it towards their renewals. So we're not asking them for anything more and above, just different. The other big thing on here is the statutes that have just been recently changed, SB 1062, that's the substance abuse title change, and the scope, super, super significant. Lots of not only rule changes, but application changes. Toby learning how to say addiction counselors, which I love, by the way. I just is going to be hard for me. And in addition, on that SB 1062 is also they've kind of put in an endorsement. It didn't really belong there at first, but it got in there at the end. The endorsement, our current law says you have to be licensed in another state for 3 years at the same in the same discipline at the same level. This will change it to 1 year. So if you're licensed in another state as a marriage and family therapist at the independent level, and you've been there for a year and they have the ability to assess, diagnose, and treat, you'll be able to get licensed here. I say that because there's some social workers and counselors in different states that don't have authority to diagnose, so they wouldn't meet this requirement. Mm-hmm. So rules need to be changed for that. Rules also need to be changed for the counseling compact. We don't have social work in here because it hasn't passed yet. We can modify it if necessary. There was a request from our marriage and family credentialing committee to align the marriage and family education to the COAMP standards, and that has been a really transparent process. The board's marriage and family credentialing committee, with efforts from the outside, put together curriculum that the committee approved. But once that information was approved, it was sent over to the Arizona chapter of Marriage and Family for them to process it and work with individuals at the national level to make sure that when we have the opportunity to change the rules, if there's anything that we've missed, anything that needs to be modified, added, removed, or even no changes, we want to be able to know that. So that's when I talk about transparency. That's our job, is to make sure that everybody knows from every discipline what we're doing, so that if they have issues, they can tell the board. The other big one is updating application for temporary license requirements to allow the utilization of continuing education units acquired while holding a temporary license. So this is unique. If you have a temporary license, you can use your hours acquired for your independent level license, but you can't use a renewal. You can't use your CEUs. And so That's all we want to do. If you have a temporary license, why wouldn't you be able to use your CEUs? The way it's worded now, you're not. So we're hoping that that will change. And then the other biggest thing is clinical supervisors. So, and I don't know what this is going to look like yet, but for any of you that are on the board or anybody that's listening to this audio, we are consistently having issues with clinical supervisors not doing what they've signed up to do. And oftentimes their reasoning is they didn't know. They didn't know the rules. They didn't know the laws. Currently, the way our clinical supervision education requirements are written, it is not clear that they even have to take clinical supervision that relates to Arizona. So somebody could take a clinical supervision course in Kansas, and maybe it might help them in the ethics field, but it's probably not going to help them in the documentation. This was something that I feel that we have to do. And I feel it very strongly. We have to do something. And what this is going to look like is that our board will approve clinical supervision training. So if you want to provide clinical supervision training in Arizona to our Arizona clinical supervisors, that program, that training that you want to provide has to be approved by our board. I think it's huge. I mean, that means the curriculum is going to be reviewed. Maybe it's going to be reviewed by me, maybe from the committee, maybe by the board. We don't know what any of that looks like yet. But I think that's really important. I think it's important for our board to know what's being taught. And I also think I think it's twofold. I think that people are going to learn a lot more. And I think secondly, if they didn't learn it, it will give us the right to take action on their license. If they, you know, have attended something that we've supported and they didn't know that you couldn't have a sexual relationship with your supervisee. True story. So I'm really excited about that one. But we're going to have to put all that together. So what I'm asking for the board members to do today is basically just an action vote, a motion to allow board staff to move forward with rulemaking. What that will look like is we will work primarily, Ms. Knapp will work with the rule writer to continue our rulemaking from last year. Once all of the rule, like a package, gets together, it then becomes very public. It'll go on our board's website. We'll have two public hearings. We'll do everything we can through Facebook for those that you have it, through our newsletter for those of you that try not to unsubscribe and actually read it. And I think even at every board meeting, I'm going to remind people that we have a rulemaking package, because every single time I feel like we do our best at sharing. And every single time I have somebody that comes in, they had no idea we were going through a rulemaking process. And I think it's important. I think it's important for people to know it. I think it's important for people to be involved. Are there any questions on that before I ask for that motion?
Oh, no questions.
Okay.
Comments, but no questions. I'm going to pass on the comments.
Anybody want to make a motion? I can make it.
Is it just a motion for the board staff to continue rulemaking?
Correct.
So moved, Trotter.
Plus your second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And Madam Chair, lunch is here.
Okay, sounds
and
good.
Just for the record, we just have one matter after this that probably will take about 15 minutes. And again, we had to wait for Ms. Baskin, who is the legal advisor on that matter. That's why we weren't able to do it sooner. So
so we break until 1 o'clock?
I think 1 o'clock would be fair for the okay. New members to get to know everybody, and we'll make sure that Ms. Baskin's back on at 1 o'clock.
Okay. Do I need a vote? So a board is breaking at 12:16 and we'll return at 1. Mics on, please. The board is back in session at 1:01, and we are moving to item number 5, administrative hearing. I understand this. Okay. Is Ms. Baskin on the phone? Okay. Ms. Baskin?
Yes. Good afternoon. This is Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General.
Hi, this is Adeles Amig, the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiner's Chairperson. We're ready to move to item number 5, and the meeting is being recorded. I'm sitting here with members of the staff and board members, as well as public members.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
So this is the time set for consideration of the administrative law judge's recommended decision in case number 2023-0161, Arturo Morales, licensed associate counselor. Are the parties present?
Yes, good afternoon. This is Mona Baskin appearing on behalf of the state of Arizona.
Thank you. And is Mr. Morales?
Madam Chair, could I maybe do a brief overview?
Sure.
Just to before we begin, just because this is not something our board typically sees. And
thank you.
So I'll just kind of just do a brief overview of what this is today, and then we can kind of move forward. So this individual, Mr. Morales, submitted an application in November of 2022. The board heard the facts of the matter, and the board members in June of 23 denied his application for unprofessional conduct. Mr. Morales at that time asked for a formal hearing in front of the Office of Administration, which took place in April of 2024. Mr. Morales was represented with Mr. Barber. And at this time, OAA has reached a recommendation, which you're going to be reviewing today. But just as a matter of record, Mr. Barber and Mr. Morales will not be in attendance today. Mr. Barber said that that they would not be in attendance, and there was no objection to the recommendation. And that's all.
Thank you. Okay. So as a preliminary matter, I will be asking all board members to indicate that they have received and reviewed the administrative record for the formal hearing in the matter of this associate license, Arturo Morales. So if I could have a roll call, please.
Christina Gross.
Aye.
Crystal Krueger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
Thank you. The board will now hear oral arguments from the state, from the parties, on the recommended decisions. Please understand that this is not time for Mr. Morales to re-engage and argue in the case. So first, if we can hear the statement from the state, and the state has the burden of proof in this matter, and you can go ahead, Ms. Baskin.
Yes, thank you. Members of the board, Ms. Meek, Mona Baskin, Assistant Attorney General. Regarding this case, as Ms. Zavala correctly stated, the board denied this application based on multiple acts of unprofessional conduct. A hearing was requested. The matter was delayed based on Mr. Morales's request. The hearing was held, and we do have a recommended decision at the hearing. We had Mr. Morales was represented by Mr. Benton Barber. In the case, the board considered state's exhibits one through seven. They also, the ALJ also considered the appendix items A and B, which outlined the stats were cited in the complaint and notice of hearing. The ALJ has issued her recommended decision with eight findings of fact and three conclusions of law. In her recommended order, she recommended the board's denial of applicant's application for licensure as a licensed associate counselor be affirmed. So she did affirm the board's initial decision regarding licensure. This case involved very, very serious allegations that Mr. Morales engaged in sexual conduct with an elderly psychiatric patient while he was working certified nursing assistant that resulted in him voluntarily his license to that board. So based on the egregiousness of his conduct and the violations pursuant to ARS 32-3275A5 and 6 and ARS 32-3251-16L, the state respectfully requests that the board adopt the recommended ALJ's decision, the findings of facts, conclusions of law, and the order in this case. And also, I would ask that you note that there was no objection to the recommended decision based on Ms. Zavala's conversation with Mr. Barber on behalf of his client, Mr. Arturo Morales.
Thank you, Ms. Baskin. Given that the respondent is not here, we're going to move to board deliberation. Having reviewed the administrative law judge's proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in this case, the administrative record and the arguments from the state and the information received from Mr. Morales and his attorney, the board will discuss its decision. In the event that the board votes to consider modifications, the parties will have an opportunity to meet and confer regarding the proposed changes prior to the board's vote. So this is the time for board members to discuss. Does anybody have any comments? I think that the information is very clear. Allegations, you know, and findings have not been denied. It's a thorough investigation, and we have clear evidence. With that said, is there a motion on the findings of fact?
I would make a motion to adopt the findings of fact as proposed.
Second, Trotter.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The next issue for discussion is the conclusion of law. And quick reminder, right, that the being clear and convincing evidence is a heightened standard of proof that indicates that the thing is highly or reasonably certain. Based on the findings of facts 1 through 17, the administrative law judge concludes that respondent has failed to establish clear and convincing evidence that he meets the minimum requirements for licensure based on violations of ARS 3232.71A5 and A6 and ARS 3232.51.16.1.
Excuse me, I believe that's L.
L? Okay.
Am I correct? Yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't hear very well. Ms. Saval, I would turn to you.
Yes, it's L.
It is. Okay. I couldn't hear. Thank you.
Yes. So 3232.51.16.L.
Thank you.
Do I have a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, just for a moment, Scott Donald, Assistant Attorney General, acting as independent advisor. In the event the board is going to adopt the conclusions of law, I would like to point out that in conclusion of law number 3, there is what appears to be a Scrivener's error on line 17 of the page. It states, concludes that respondent has failed to establish by board, has established by clear and convincing evidence. I believe the administrative law judge may have made an editing error with this. So I would recommend the board, were they to adopt the conclusions of law, that they modify conclusion of law number 3 to rectify the Scrivener's error. This would be a de minimis modification and would not require any kind of a notification.
Okay. So just, okay. Do I have a motion to modify the findings as stated?
May I be heard on this? I'm sorry. This is. I want to be clear that this is just a technical violation, and it would not be considered. I don't want to be considered as a statutory modification. It's just a technical cleanup of the language. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank
absolutely.
You. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So it's a different motion. Do I have?
So my motion, Palacios moves to adopt the conclusions law proposed with the modification of the language.
Trotter second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The next issue for discussion is the conclusion of law. Is there a motion to adopt the conclusion of law, modify the conclusion of law, or reject the conclusion of law?
I think that's what the board just did, Madam Chair.
Right.
I'm sorry, Ms. Baskin. I'm sorry. Back to the final issue for discussion is the board's order. The board may make a motion to accept the AG's recommended order or may make a motion to modify or reject it and substitute a different decision. So now it's time for the board to make a motion.
Yeah, a motion to accept the ALG's recommended order. Trotter.
Palacio second.
And I would like a roll call for this.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Crystal Krueger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Palacios.
Aye.
Antoine Trotter.
Aye.
So this concludes this matter before the board. The board's decision will be reduced to writing and sent out the parties shortly. The parties' further appeal rights will be sent forth in the board's written order. Thank you, everybody. This concludes this matter.
Thank you, Ms. Fass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Ms. Zavala, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next on our agenda is future agenda items. If any board members have any items that you would like to be placed on the agenda, please contact Ms. Zavala directly. Next item is number 15, call for public comment. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any given public matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 5 minutes to do so, pursuant to ARS 38431.01H. The board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Action on public comment matters that are not listed on the agenda will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to schedule the matter for further discussion at a later date. Do I have anybody in the audience or the public that wants to address the board? Having no volunteers, we move to the next item. Number 16, the next regular meeting is scheduled for Friday, July 12th at 9 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C. So far, Ms. Zavala?
Madam Chair, at this time, Ms. Kruger will not be available to be at the July meeting, but other than that, I've got confirmation from everybody else that they'll be in attendance. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct. All right. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So move, Trotter.
Let's do a second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting adjourned at 1:15. Thank you. See you all next month.